Prologue. Dot 1. The archive node designated Structure 17 sat in the outer reaches of the Lakai 801760 system, where nothing lived and nothing visited, and the only light came from a red dwarf star 4 billion years older than the species that had recently learned to listen to its transmissions. The structure was beautiful, in the way that all the predecessor structures were beautiful, a geometry that suggested mathematics humanity hadn't invented yet. Surfaces that absorbed and reflected light in patterns that shifted depending on the angle of observation, as though the thing were perpetually deciding what it wanted to look like. It was 700 meters long and roughly cylindrical, though the word roughly was doing more work than usual. It hung in the nothing between planets, broadcasting its portion of the predecessor archive to anyone with a receiver, which was increasingly everyone. The research vessel Kiran Desai had been stationed at Structure 17 for 4 months. A crew of 11, three archive linguists, two substrate physicists, a communications specialist, a medic, and four operations crew, living in a converted hauler that had been retrofitted with archive monitoring equipment and not nearly enough shower pressure. They were cataloging the node's output, cross-referencing it with decoded segments from other sites, doing the slow and mostly tedious work of building an index for a library that contained the knowledge of a dead civilization. Dr. Yuki Tanaka was alone in the monitoring lab at 340 station time, running a batch correlation on substrate harmonics, when she stopped being Dr. Yuki Tanaka. She didn't feel it happen. There was no sensation of intrusion, no moment of transition, no awareness of a boundary being crossed. One moment she was watching frequency analysis scroll across her display, thinking about whether she'd remembered to message her sister on Europa about the birthday gift, and the next moment 40 minutes had passed, and she was standing at the primary archive interface terminal with her hands on the input surface. The terminal was active. The access logs showed a deep query, not the surface-level archive data that the research team had been authorized to study, but something far below, in substrate layers that the transport union had classified as restricted pending further analysis. The query was precise, surgical, moving through the archive's nested architecture with a fluency that no human researcher had achieved in 7 years of study. It navigated the predecessor's organizational structure not the way someone reads a map, but the way someone walks through their own home, turning corners without looking, reaching for doors without checking if they're there. The query had accessed 11 discrete data clusters in 40 minutes. All of them were in the same domain: substrate maintenance protocols, consciousness preservation systems, the technology the predecessors had used to keep their distributed intelligence coherent across billions of years. The query was still running. Tanaka looked at her hands on the terminal surface. They weren't shaking. They should have been shaking. She pulled them away and the query died, the access log freezing mid-entry, the deep archive layers closing behind the retreating connection, like water filling a hole. She looked at the screen. The data retrieved during the 40-minute window was displayed in predecessor notation. Angular, recursive symbols that humanity had only partially decoded. But it wasn't the retrieved data that made her stomach drop. It was the query syntax. The way the search had been structured, the paths it had taken through the archive's nested layers. It wasn't the fumbling exploration of a human researcher learning the system. It was native, fluent. The query had been written in the archive's own language, using organizational protocols that no one at any research site had fully mapped. Someone, something, had used her hands to search the archive, and it had searched the way the builders would have searched, with the casual expertise of authorship. Tanaka backed away from the terminal. The monitoring lab was quiet. The hum of the recyclers, the faint tick of thermal expansion in the hull plating, the sub-audible drone of Structure 17's broadcast signal vibrating through the ship's frame. Normal sounds, nothing out of place. She checked her hands, no marks, no residue. She checked the clock, 422. 42 minutes unaccounted for. She checked the security feed and watched herself, or the thing wearing her, stand up from the analysis station at 340, walk calmly to the archive terminal, place her hands on the input surface, and stand perfectly still for 40 minutes while data scrolled past at speeds no human eye could track. She hadn't blinked, not once in 42 minutes. Her face on the security feed was calm, vacant, focused. The expression of a person who was not there. Tanaka sat down on the lab floor and wrapped her arms around her knees and breathed. The air tasted like recycler and coffee and nothing else. She was alone. She was sure she was alone. She wasn't sure she was alone. After a while she got up and went to wake the medic. Her hands were steady. Her pulse was elevated but not critical. The medic ran a neurological panel, standard transport union protocol for any anomalous event at a structure site, and found nothing wrong. Heart rate normal. Blood oxygen, normal. Neural activity, normal. Except a brief note in the scan results, flagged by the diagnostic software but not highlighted as critical. An unusual pattern in the temporal and parietal lobes during the 40-minute window. Not pathological. Not a seizure, not a stroke, not a tumor. Just an alteration. A brief reorganization of neural activity into a pattern the diagnostic software didn't recognize. The software filed it as an artifact. Sensor noise. The kind of thing you ignore because the alternative is too strange to process. The medic filed the report. Standard protocol. It went into the Transport Union's medical database, where it joined 10 other reports from 6 other systems filed over the preceding 11 days. All of them described the same thing. A brief altered state. A period of time unaccounted for. An archive terminal accessed with impossible expertise, and a neural scan showing the same unrecognized pattern in the same brain regions. Nobody had connected them yet. Nobody was looking for a pattern because nobody had imagined there might be one. 11 incidents across the settled systems. A researcher at Lakai. An engineer on Medina Station. A cargo clerk on Ganymede. A botanist in the Jovian Trojans. Others scattered across the network of humanity's expansion. And each one isolated, reported, and filed without alarm. But the access logs told a different story. If anyone had thought to compare them, and someone would soon, they would have seen 11 queries, fired simultaneously across 6 star systems, all targeting the same archive domain, all using the same native fluent search syntax, all retrieving fragments of the same dataset. Substrate stabilization. Consciousness preservation. The technology of not dying. Something was reaching through human minds to read its own library, and it was running out of time. In the monitoring lab of the Kirin Desai, Structure 17's broadcast hummed on. The predecessor archive, 4 billion years of accumulated knowledge, sang into the dark. And somewhere in the archive's deepest substrate layer, woven into the fabric of the system like a thread in a tapestry, the 48th voice, the human note in an alien chord, resonated differently than it had before. Not louder, not alarmed, just attentive. The way a detective's attention shifts when something moves in the corner of his eye. Chapter 1. Holden. 7 years was long enough to turn a miracle into paperwork. Holden sat in the ops deck of the Rocinante. Same chair, same console, same view of stars through the cockpit window that he'd been staring at for the better part of 2 decades, and reviewed the week's survey logs with the enthusiasm of a man filling out tax forms. Structure 41. Sigma Draconis system broadcasting normally. Archive output consistent with baseline. No anomalous emissions, no substrate fluctuations, no unexpected visitors. Another node doing exactly what it had been doing for 4 billion years, which was singing a dead civilization song into the void, and which humanity had been monitoring for 7 years, with the increasing boredom of a species that had learned to take cosmic revelations for granted. He was 48 years old. The cascade felt like it had happened to someone else. The Rossi was an archive survey vessel now, contracted to the Transport Union to make quarterly rounds of the outer system structures. It was good work. Steady, well compensated, important in the abstract way that all scientific infrastructure was important. The kind of work that mattered enormously and felt like nothing. Holden had triggered the cascade that opened the predecessor archive to the entire human species, and now he was essentially a park ranger, checking the fences around monuments that couldn't be damaged and didn't need guarding. He told himself he didn't miss the old days. He told himself that 7 years of relative peace, of no one shooting at them, of the crew aging into something like contentment, was exactly what they'd earned. He told himself this while staring at the survey logs and feeling the particular itch that came from being a man who needed a crisis, and was ashamed of needing one. "You're doing the face," Alex said over the internal comm. He was in the cockpit, running pre-burn calculations for their transit to the next survey point. "I don't have a face." "You've got the face where you're looking at something boring and wishing it was a distress call. I've been watching that face for 20 years, Haas. I know it like I know the sound of Reactor 3. Holden didn't answer, which was its own answer. Alex let it go, the way Alex had been letting things go for 2 decades, with the patience of a man who understood that sometimes the kindest thing you could do for someone was pretend you hadn't noticed them being an idiot. Naomi was in the engineering bay. She'd been there since 400, running her own analysis of Structure 41's output, not the survey data, the real data, the deep archive layers that the transport union had been slowly, methodically decoding for 7 years. Naomi was the foremost living expert on predecessor archive architecture, a distinction she'd earned by being the first person to decode a predecessor signal and then spending every available hour since deepening that expertise. She had published more papers on predecessor communication protocols than any 10 other researchers combined, and she had read approximately none of them after publication, because the papers were politics and the data was the point. She didn't come up to the ops deck as much as she used to. Holden tried not to read anything into that. Amos was in the machine shop, doing something to a coupling that didn't need doing, because Amos always needed his hands busy and the Rossi had been running clean for months. The ship was getting old. They all were. But Amos kept her in fighting shape through sheer stubbornness and an apparently inexhaustible supply of spare parts, sourced from contacts whose names Holden had learned not to ask about. The four of them had been together for so long now that the silences had become a language of their own. They didn't talk about Miller anymore. Not because the memory was painful, though it was, but because there was nothing left to say that the silence didn't already hold. The 48th voice in the archive, the human note in an alien chord. Sometimes, during a survey pass, Naomi would catch a slight variation in the archive's output, a harmonic that shifted when the Rossi was near, as if some fragment of the pattern remembered the ship that had carried it. She never mentioned it. Holden never asked. Some things were better left in the space between knowing and saying. Outside the cockpit window, Structure 41 hung in the dark like a monument to something so far beyond human comprehension that even the comprehension was beyond human comprehension. 7 years of study had decoded perhaps 12% of the archive's surface layers, enough to revolutionize materials science, quantum mechanics, and 3 branches of mathematics that hadn't existed before the cascade. Enough to make humanity feel both impossibly advanced and impossibly small. The deeper layers remained opaque, structured in encoding schemes that seemed designed for minds organized differently than human minds, which was exactly what they were. The universe had handed humanity a library. Humanity was still learning to read. The comm chimed. Priority channel, transport union routing. Holden straightened in his chair, and something in his chest, something he would never admit to, lit up. Rocinante, this is transport union operations. Captain Holden, we're flagging a security alert across your survey corridor. Multiple unauthorized archive access events detected in the last 72 hours. 4 systems, 11 incidents. We're requesting all survey vessels in the affected sectors to report any anomalous activity and stand by for further instructions. Holden read the attached briefing while the comm officer talked. 4 star systems, 11 incidents. Unauthorized access to restricted archive layers, not the public-facing data that anyone could access with a standard receiver, but the deep substrate, the underlying architecture that the transport union had classified as sensitive pending full analysis. The kind of data that required physical proximity to a structure node and specialized interface equipment. The access methods were identical across all 11 incidents. Same query syntax, same target domain, same retrieval patterns. As if one person had accessed the archive from 11 different locations simultaneously. Alex, Holden said. You seeing this? 4 systems at once. Unless someone's figured out how to be in 4 places at the same time, this isn't one person. Could be a coordinated operation. Intelligence service, maybe. Mars still has people who think the archive should be classified. Could be, Alex said, in the tone that meant he didn't think so. Holden pulled up the access logs. The query syntax was dense, technical, and completely unlike anything he'd seen from any human research team. The archive's organizational structure was notoriously difficult to navigate. 7 years of dedicated effort had mapped perhaps 12% of the substrate layers, and every new discovery revealed another level of complexity beneath it. The queries in the access logs moved through the archive like water through pipes, following paths that the research community hadn't even identified yet. He forwarded the data to Naomi Dital. Her response came back in 4 minutes, which meant she'd taken it seriously enough to stop what she was doing and look. That, more than anything in the briefing, told him something was wrong. Holden, come down to engineering. He went. Naomi was at her main workstation, the big display showing a three-dimensional map of archive substrate layers that looked like a city seen from above. Branching pathways, nested clusters, recursive structures, folding in on themselves in patterns that made Holden's eyes water if he stared too long. The access events were highlighted in red, 11 points of entry scattered across the map. "Look at the paths," Naomi said. She didn't look up. Holden looked. The red lines traced routes through the archive's architecture, each one moving from a surface access point down through increasingly restricted layers to a cluster of data nodes deep in the substrate. The routes were different. 11 different entry points, 11 different paths, but they all converged on the same destination. "They're all going to the same place." "Yes, but that's not what's interesting." Naomi highlighted the path geometry. "Watch how they navigate the branching points." Holden watched. At every junction in the archive's layered structure, where a human researcher would need to pause, orient, query the local architecture, and choose a path, the intruder moved without hesitation. No wrong turns, no backtracking. No exploratory queries. Every navigation decision was instantaneous and correct, taking the shortest possible route through a structure that humanity had spent 7 years learning to read and still mostly couldn't. "That's not decryption," Holden said. "That's not someone who cracked the system." "No, that's someone who already knows the system. Not learned, knows. The way I know the Rosii's wiring. The way you know this ship's corridors in the dark." Naomi finally looked up. Her face was controlled, precise, the way it got when she was scared and didn't want to show it. "Holden, whoever did this didn't decode the archive's navigation structure. They wrote it." The words hung in the air between them, in the engineering bay of a ship that had spent 7 years flying routine surveys of structures built by a civilization that had died 4 billion years ago. A civilization whose archive was now public, whose echo had been contacted, whose last trace had been preserved in 47 indestructible transmitters and one human pattern woven into their fabric. "That's not possible," Holden said. "The predecessors are dead. The entity is, it's out there, 1,200 light-years away, processing its own history. It communicated once, through the cascade. The substrate medium. It couldn't. I'm not saying the entity did this. The entity's communication was through the substrate, not through human beings. This is different. This used people, Holden, human researchers at archive terminals. They accessed the data with their own credentials, through their own equipment, using their own hands, and then they didn't remember doing it." Holden sat down. The chair was cold. The engineering bay was always cold. Naomi kept it that way because the analysis equipment ran better at lower temperatures, and because Naomi herself ran better when she could wear the heavy sweater she'd bought on Ceres 8 years ago. The one with the unraveling cuff that she refused to let him fix. What data were they accessing? Naomi turned back to her display. She pulled up the retrieved content. Predecessor notation, angular and recursive, partially decoded by algorithms that she'd spent years refining. She ran the translation, and the results filled the screen with terms that Holden recognized from years of archive briefings. "Substrate stabilization," Naomi said. "Consciousness preservation. The technology the predecessors used to maintain their distributed intelligence across their structures. The stuff that kept them coherent for 4 billion years, she paused. "The same technology they ultimately couldn't maintain. The stuff that failed, that let their patterns decay, that killed them. Someone's looking for the predecessors' immortality tech. Someone with native access to the archive's architecture is reaching through human minds to find the data that would have saved the predecessors from extinction." Naomi's voice was flat, controlled, each word placed like a brick. "And they're doing it across 4 star systems simultaneously." Holden's hand found the comm panel by habit, the muscle memory of a man who had spent his adult life reaching for the broadcast button when the universe handed him something too big to keep quiet. Naomi caught his hand. "Don't. The transport union needs to—" "The transport union already has the access logs. They'll see the same thing I see. But if you broadcast this, something is possessing researchers to steal alien immortality technology. You know what happens." He did know. He'd been the man who broadcast the truth for 20 years, and he'd learned that the truth, once loose, didn't behave. It didn't inform. It detonated. And the shrapnel hit whatever was closest, which was usually the people who needed protection most. He thought about the cascade, the moment he'd touched the construct in Node 12's convergence room, and felt the entire network ignite, 47 structures lighting up across human space like a circuit completing. He'd made that choice alone, in a room no one else could reach, and the universe had changed. He'd been right to do it. He still believed that most days, but the weight of it had settled into him the way gravity settles into bone. You could carry it. You did carry it. But you never forgot it was there. If I don't broadcast it, and people get hurt. If you do broadcast it, and people panic, and some admiral decides to solve the problem with torpedoes, and the conduits, the people being used, become targets instead of victims, then people get hurt too. Different people. More of them, maybe. It was the argument they'd been having for 20 years, refined by time into something that was less a disagreement than a calibration. How much truth, how fast, to whom. The needle never landed in the same place twice. So what do we do? Naomi turned back to the display. The 11 access points glowed red in the archive's architecture, and somewhere beneath them, in layers of data that humanity had barely begun to understand, something had reached out through borrowed hands and searched for the one thing it needed to survive. We follow the trail, Naomi said, quietly, before someone else follows it loudly. Holden looked at the display. He thought about Miller. Not the detective, not the ghost, not the pattern woven into the archive. The memory, the man who had taught him without ever meaning to that the most dangerous thing in the universe wasn't the truth. It was the silence around it. Miller would have followed the trail. Miller would have followed it all the way down into whatever waited at the bottom, because that was what detectives did. You followed the evidence. You didn't stop because the evidence scared you. But Miller was gone, dissolved into the archive, a human thread in an alien tapestry, and whatever remained of his pattern was no longer a detective, and no longer a ghost, and no longer anything that could tell Holden what to do when the universe handed him something too big to carry, and too important to set down. Holden was on his own. He had been for 7 years. He was starting to suspect that this was the point, that the universe kept asking the same question not because it expected a perfect answer, but because it wanted to see what kind of species kept trying. He thought about the 11 people across 4 systems who had lost pieces of themselves. 40 minutes, an hour, whatever the duration, to something that had reached through the gap between alien technology and human neurology, and used their hands to search for a way not to die. Those people were frightened. They were confused. And they were about to become very, very interesting to a lot of powerful factions who would see them not as victims but as resources. He thought about being 48 years old, and still being the person who had to answer. Alex, he said over the comm. Change of plans. Plot a course for Lakai 8060. Priority burn. What's at Lakai? Structure 17. A research vessel called the Kiran Desai. And 11 people who need to tell us what happened to them before someone with more guns and less patience asks first. Alex didn't ask why. After 20 years, he didn't need to. The Rossi's drive lit, and the stars shifted, and James Holden went to find out what was reaching through the dark with borrowed hands. The universe was asking again. It always did. Chapter 2. Ren Y. The ice hauler Korematsu was 3 days out from Palace Station when Ren Vasquez realized he'd forgotten to call his mother again. He thought about it while he was elbow deep in the number 2 water recycler, replacing a membrane that had started to calcify in the way that membranes did when you push them 6 months past their rated service life, because replacement parts cost money, and the Korematsu's operating margins were the kind of thin that made you reconsider whether eating was strictly necessary. The membrane came out in pieces. Ren caught the fragments before they could drift into the pump assembly, because he'd been doing this since he was 19. And his hands knew the work even when his brain was somewhere else. His brain was frequently somewhere else. Not in the productive way, not solving problems, not running calculations, not doing the quiet engineering math that was his actual job. Just drifting. The way you drift when you're 26 and hauling ice between stations on a ship held together by sealant and optimism. And the most exciting thing that's happened to you in the last year is a coupling failure on the port thruster, that you fixed in 40 minutes with a wrench and a piece of conduit you weren't supposed to know how to fabricate. His mother would want to know how he was doing. She always did. Dr. B. Maria Vasquez Chen, lead researcher at the Archive Analysis Institute on Tycho, one of the foremost experts on predecessor substrate architecture, the woman who had helped decode the two-way interface protocols that made the cascade possible. And she still called her son every week to ask if he was eating enough protein. and whether the Korematsu's air filters had been changed recently. The answer to both questions was usually no. Dao. He should call her. He would call her. After he fixed the membrane and ran diagnostics on the number 3 reactor coupling and ate something that wasn't a protein bar and slept for more than 5 hours. So probably next week. The Korematsu's comm chimed. Ren pulled his hands out of the recycler and wiped them on his jumpsuit, leaving streaks of calcium residue that looked like chalk marks on the dark fabric. Vasquez, Captain Okoye's voice was flat, the way it got when she was reading something she didn't like. We're being diverted. Diverted where? Relay Station 14. Transport Union Priority Routing. They want us there in 18 hours. Ren did the math automatically. Relay 14 was a communications hub on the network edge, one of the smaller stations that maintained archived data links between the outer system nodes. It was also in the opposite direction from their delivery schedule. That'll put us 2 days behind on the palace drop. I'm aware. The penalty clause. I'm aware of the penalty clause, Vasquez. The 2 is covering our costs plus 15%. Whatever they need at 14, they needed enough to pay for it. Ren went back to the membrane. Transport Union diversions weren't unusual. The 2 maintained thousands of relay stations, and sometimes needed civilian ships for maintenance runs when their own fleet was stretched thin. It was boring work, usually. Swap a comm module, recalibrate a dish, replace a fuse. The kind of work that paid well precisely because it was so far out of the way that nobody wanted to do it. He finished the membrane replacement, ran the recycler through a test cycle, confirmed flow rates were within tolerance, cleaned his tools, stowed his kit, and went to the galley to eat something. The protein bar tasted like compressed regret. He ate it anyway. The Korematsu had a crew of 4. Captain Okoye, who had been running ice routes for 30 years and treated every deviation from schedule as a personal insult. Dimitri, the pilot, who slept 14 hours a day and was awake for the other 10 in a state of aggressive competence. And Yara, who handled cargo and comms and kept the ship's administrative life from collapsing into paperwork entropy. Ren was the engineer. He'd been the engineer on 3 different haulers since he was 19, each one slightly less terrible than the last, and the Korematsu was the least terrible of all, which meant the water recycler only broke every 6 weeks instead of every 3. It was a living. It wasn't his mother's living. It wasn't research grants and institutional prestige and conference presentations on the nature of 4-billion-year-old alien technology. But it was his. He'd chosen it deliberately, the way some children of famous parents choose professions as far from the family business as possible, not out of rebellion but out of self-knowledge. He wasn't a scientist. He was a mechanic with a good education and steady hands and an inherited knack for seeing how systems fit together that his mother attributed to genetics, and he attributed to growing up in a household where the dinner table conversation was about substrate topology. Relay Station 14 was a standard 2 communications hub, a pressurized cylinder roughly the size of a shuttle, bristling with antenna arrays and archive data receivers, orbiting a rock that didn't have a name, only a catalog number. It was unmanned. Most relay stations were. They ran on automated systems that were simple enough to be reliable and complex enough that when they broke, you needed an engineer, not a software patch. Ren docked the Korematsu at the station's maintenance port, suited up and crossed the umbilical into the station's interior. The air was stale but breathable. The lights came on automatically, flickering in the way that fluorescents do when they've been alone too long. The work order said the station's archive data relay had flagged an alignment error. Standard procedure. Check the physical array. Recalibrate the receiver. Verify the data link to the nearest structure node. 2 hours, maybe 3. Ren had done it a dozen times. He found the relay control room on the station's upper deck. It was small, barely room for 1 person and a console. The archive data terminal sat against the far wall, its screen dark, its input surface cool. The terminal was restricted. Transport Union clearance required, flagged as sensitive per the archive access protocols that had been in place since the Cascade. Ren didn't have clearance. He didn't need it. His job was the hardware, not the data. He opened his toolkit and started on the antenna alignment. The work was methodical, precise, the kind of thing his hands could do while his mind wandered. He thought about his mother's research, about the predecessor archive, singing its 4-billion-year-old song through 47 structures scattered across human space. About the entity, far away, still processing its own history, still learning what it was. About the 48th voice, the human detective who'd dissolved into the archive and become something that wasn't a person anymore but carried the shape of one. He thought about how strange it was to live in a universe where all of that was true and his job was still fixing antennas. He finished the alignment at 1420 station time. He started the calibration sequence. He checked the data link, everything nominal. He began writing up his service report. At 1423, he stopped writing. At 1503, he started again. The 40 minutes between those two timestamps did not exist in Ren Vasquez's memory. There was 1423, and there was 1503, and between them was nothing. Not blackness, not sleep, not unconsciousness. Nothing. A clean edit. As if someone had taken a blade to his timeline and removed a section with surgical precision. He was standing at the archive data terminal. His hands were on the input surface. The terminal was active, logged in with credentials he didn't have, displaying data and notation he didn't recognize. Predecessor symbols cascading across the screen, in patterns that hurt his eyes in a way that had nothing to do with brightness, and everything to do with geometry. The symbols were angular, recursive, nested inside themselves in ways that seemed to fold space into configurations his visual cortex wasn't built to process. And on the screen, in the corner, in his own handwriting, rendered in the input surface's stylus mode, were equations, not human equations, not anything from any mathematics he'd studied. Predecessor notation, written in his hand, in a script he had never seen before this moment. His hands were steady. They shouldn't have been steady. Ren pulled his hands off the terminal. The screen froze. The data hung there, predecessor symbols and his own handwriting side by side, like evidence from two different crime scenes accidentally filed together. He looked at his hands. They were clean. No chalk residue from the recycler, no grease from the antenna assembly. Just his hands attached to his arms, which were attached to him, which he had apparently not been for 40 minutes. He backed away from the terminal until he hit the opposite wall. The relay control room was small enough that this took two steps. He stood with his back against the bulkhead and looked at the screen and breathed. The equations on the screen meant nothing to him. He couldn't read predecessor notation. Fewer than 200 people in the entire system could, and most of them worked for institutions with names and budgets and security clearances. Ren Vasquez was a cargo hauler engineer who fixed things that broke and broke things that were supposed to be unbreakable, and had never in his life thought about predecessor substrate architecture except when his mother talked about it over dinner. Which was often enough that some of the vocabulary had seeped in through sheer repetition, but none of the comprehension. And yet someone had used his hands, his brain, his body, to access a restricted terminal with credentials he didn't possess, and write equations in a language he didn't speak. He should report this. He knew he should report this. The archive access protocols were clear. Any unauthorized access to restricted archive data was to be reported immediately to the Transport Union Security Division. The protocols existed because the archive was the most valuable repository of knowledge humanity had ever encountered, and because people had killed for less valuable things, and because the Transport Union had learned from the Cascade that the archive was not just a library but a channel, and channels could be used in both directions. Ren looked at the screen. He looked at his handwriting in a language he didn't know. He thought about his mother, the foremost expert on predecessor substrate architecture, who would know exactly what those equations meant, and exactly how terrified he should be. He tried to reconstruct the missing time, tried to feel backward into it the way you feel for the edge of a step in the dark. There was nothing to find. Not a gap, not a blur, not a dream, just 1423. And then 1503, and between them an absence so clean it was surgical. His body had been here, his hands had moved, his fingers had typed, his eyes had tracked, predecessor notation across the screen. But he hadn't been behind them. Whatever occupied the space where Ren Vasquez lived for those 40 minutes wasn't Ren Vasquez. The thought made his stomach drop in a way that had nothing to do with gravity, and everything to do with the sudden, visceral understanding that the boundary between you, and not you, was thinner than you thought. He'd always assumed that being himself was an irreducible fact, that the thoughts in his head were his, the movements of his hands were his, that the basic mechanism of occupying his own body was as reliable as the laws of thermodynamics. 40 minutes of nothing had disassembled that assumption with the casual efficiency of a technician pulling a faulty component. He thought about his mother, about all those dinner table conversations about substrate topology and consciousness preservation, and the technology the predecessors had used to maintain their distributed intelligence across the galaxy. She'd explained it to him once, how the predecessor mines had been patterns encoded in the substrate that connected their structures, how those patterns had eventually decayed, how the archive was what remained. She'd been excited about it, the way she was always excited about the archive, the way scientists are excited about things that are beautiful and terrible and far too large to be personal. It felt personal now. He picked up his comm. Captain Okoye, I need to report something. His voice was steady. His hands were steady. Everything about him was steady, and he didn't know why, because inside the steady exterior was a man who had just lost 40 minutes of his life to something that had reached through the gap between the archive and his nervous system and used him like a tool in a drawer, like a wrench, like a membrane puller, like any piece of equipment that does its job and doesn't need to understand why. The equations glowed on the screen behind him, predecessor notation, written in human handwriting, on a relay station at the edge of nowhere, by a 26-year-old engineer who fixed water recyclers and forgot to call his mother. Something had borrowed him, and he had no idea if it was done. Chapter 3. Drummer. The Transport Union Security Council met in a room designed to make people feel small. Drummer had chosen it for exactly that reason. The chamber occupied the central hub of Medina Station's administrative deck, a cylindrical space with walls that curved upward into shadow, ringed by display screens showing real-time data feeds from every major system in human-controlled space. Trade routes, fleet positions, population metrics, resource allocations. The visual language of power, arranged to remind everyone present that the Transport Union managed the infrastructure on which 1,300 inhabited worlds depended, and that the woman sitting at the head of the table was the reason the infrastructure worked. Kamina Drummer, president of the Transport Union, sat in her chair and watched 17 people try to blame each other for something none of them understood. The unauthorized access events are clearly coordinated, said Wei, the Earth Coalition's security liaison, a man whose suits cost more than a belter's monthly air allotment, and whose voice carried the particular authority of someone who had never personally been worried about where his next breath was coming from. The targeting of restricted archive sectors, the simultaneous timing across multiple systems, this has the signature of a state-level intelligence operation. Convenient analysis coming from Earth. That was Don, the Martian Congressional Republic's representative, whose jaw was permanently set in the expression of a man who believed everyone else in the room was either lying or stupid or both. Perhaps you'd like to explain why 3 of the 11 access events occurred at research stations funded by Earth-based institutions. Perhaps you'd like to explain why Martian Naval Intelligence has had 2 destroyers shadowing archive structure sites for the past 4 months. Routine patrol assignments. Routine. Why let the word hang? Drummer let them go. Not because the argument was productive, it wasn't, and everyone in the room knew it wasn't. But because letting factions exhaust their opening positions was cheaper than interrupting them. They'd accuse each other, posture, make threats wrapped in diplomatic language, and eventually run out of ammunition. Then she could talk. She'd been Transport Union president for 5 years. Before that, she'd been the captain of a warship. And before that, she'd been a dock worker. And before that, she'd been a kid on Ceres who learned early that the universe didn't give a shit about you, and the only thing that kept the darkness at bay was infrastructure. Water systems, air processors, docking protocols, trade routes, the machinery of civilization, the things that worked when someone made them work and fell apart when no one did. The archive was infrastructure now, the biggest, most important infrastructure humanity had ever built, or rather, inherited. 47 structures broadcasting the accumulated knowledge of a 4-billion-year-old civilization, accessible to anyone with a receiver, maintained by the Transport Union under protocols that Drummer had personally helped draft. Open access. Non-exclusive. The Cascade had opened the archive to everyone, and Drummer's job was to make sure everyone meant everyone. The argument was winding down. Wei and Don had exhausted their mutual accusations. The Belt representatives, 3 of them, because the Belt could never agree on a single voice for anything, were conferring in low Belter Creole. The Independent Systems delegate was checking her hand terminal, which meant she was bored, which meant she'd vote with whoever spoke most convincingly, which was always Drummer. Enough. Drummer's voice wasn't loud. It didn't need to be. She'd spent a career learning to speak at the exact volume that made people stop talking and start listening, which was quieter than most people expected. The room went silent. I've read the same reports you've read. 11 unauthorized access events across 6 star systems in 11 days. Restricted archive layers targeted. Identical query syntax in every case. She paused. And every one of you has spent the last 40 minutes accusing each other, which tells me none of you have read the medical reports. She pulled up the data on the main display. 11 personnel files, 11 medical scans, 11 neurological panels. The faces were different. Researchers, technicians, a cargo clerk, a station administrator. Different ages, different backgrounds, different systems. Nothing connecting them except the timestamps. 11 people accessed restricted archive data using credentials they didn't have, through systems they weren't authorized to use, during periods of time they don't remember. Every one of them has the same anomaly in their neurological panel. She highlighted the relevant section. An altered pattern in the temporal and parietal lobes that doesn't match any known pathology. Not a seizure, not a stroke, not a tumor. Not drug-induced. Not consistent with any form of coercion or hypnosis currently understood by medical science. The room was very quiet. This isn't an intelligence operation. No intelligence service on record has the ability to simultaneously compromise 11 individuals across 6-star systems and leave identical neurological signatures that don't match any known technique. She looked at Wei. It's not Earth. She looked at Dawn. It's not Mars. She looked at the Belt delegation. It's not any of you. Then what is it? Wei's voice had lost its diplomatic polish. Under the suit, he was scared. Drummer could see it in the way his hand stayed flat on the table, as if the table were the only solid thing in the room. Drummer pulled up the access logs, the query paths through the archive's substrate, highlighted in red on a three-dimensional map that looked like a city built by someone who thought in more than three dimensions. The paths were precise, clean, navigating the archive's nested architecture with the fluency of native comprehension. Something is using people to access the archive, briefly, temporarily, without their knowledge or consent. It's accessing data that we've classified as restricted, substrate stabilization protocols, consciousness preservation technology. And it's doing it with a level of familiarity with the archive's internal structure that no human researcher has achieved in 7 years of dedicated study. She let that sit. The access syntax is native. Not decoded. Native. Whoever, whatever is doing this, didn't learn how the archive works. It already knew. Don leaned forward. You're suggesting this is alien. I'm not suggesting anything. I'm telling you what the data shows. What it means is what we're here to determine. The predecessors are dead, Wei said, but his voice had the tone of a man reciting a fact he was no longer sure of. The entity is 1,200 light-years away. The archive is a recording. There's no mechanism we know of. There's a difference. Drummer closed the display. The room stayed quiet. 17 people sitting in a room designed to make them feel small. And for the first time in Drummer's tenure, the room was working as intended. Here's what's going to happen. The Transport Union is assuming jurisdiction over all archive access events pending investigation. No unilateral action by any faction. No military deployment to archive sites without two authorization. No public statements until we understand what we're dealing with. She looked around the table. Anyone who has a problem with that can file a formal objection through the standard channels, which I will read with great interest and then ignore. No one filed an objection. They rarely did when Drummer used that voice. The Rocinante is already en route to the most recent access site. Captain Holden has operational authority for the investigation. She saw the reactions. Wei's carefully neutral expression, Dan's flicker of irritation, the Belt delegate's subtle nods. Holden was controversial. Holden was always controversial. But Holden had triggered the cascade, and Holden had the only crew in the system with direct experience interfacing with predecessor technology, and Holden would broadcast everything he found to every open channel in human space, which meant nobody could accuse him of burying information for political advantage. Drummer stood. The meeting was over. She'd gotten what she needed. Jurisdiction, compliance, time. How much time depended on how fast the factions recovered from being scared and started scheming again. Experience suggested 72 hours, maybe less. She walked back to her office through corridors that hummed with the steady vibration of Medina Station's life support systems. The hum was infrastructure. The hum was civilization. The hum was the sound of someone making the machinery work so that everyone else could breathe. Something was using people like tools. Reaching through the gap between alien technology and human neurology and operating human beings the way Drummer operated a console. With practiced efficiency and no concern for the console's opinion about being operated. The thought made her jaw tighten in a way that had nothing to do with politics and everything to do with the foundational principle that she'd built her entire career on. People weren't infrastructure. People weren't tools. People weren't relay stations or data terminals or mechanisms to be operated by whatever came along with the right interface. Whatever was reaching through the archive, whatever fragment of a dead civilization was using human hands to search for a way to survive, it hadn't asked. It hadn't communicated. It hadn't requested access or explained its purpose or done any of the things that sentient beings did when they needed something from other sentient beings. It had just taken. And Drummer, who had spent her life building systems that worked because everyone agreed to the rules, was going to find out who was breaking them. Even if who turned out to be something that had been dead for 4 billion years. Chapter 4. Naomi.0. The access patterns told a story. Naomi just couldn't decide what kind. She'd been staring at the data for 6 hours, hunched over her workstation in the Rocinante's engineering bay with 3 displays running simultaneously. Archive substrate topology on the left, access event timelines in the center, query path analysis on the right, and the coffee she'd made at the start of the session had gone cold twice. She'd reheated it once, the second time she'd just left it. At some point, the data had become more important than the coffee, and when that happened, Naomi knew she was either close to something or so deep in a dead end that she'd lost the ability to recognize futility. The 11 access events were mapped on the substrate topology display as red traces, paths through the archive's nested architecture, each one originating from a different star system, each one terminating at the same cluster of data nodes buried deep in the substrate's restricted layers. She'd been studying the archive's architecture for 7 years. Had published the foundational papers on predecessor organizational logic, had trained the algorithms that half the research community used for substrate navigation. She knew the archive the way a cartographer knows a continent, intimately, systematically, with the accumulated confidence of years of careful mapping. The traces on her display moved through the archive with a confidence that made her own expertise feel like a child's drawing. "Show me the branching decisions," she said to the analysis system. The display zoomed in on one of the traces, the Lakai 8760 event, the one from the Kiran Desai, and highlighted every point where the path had reached a junction in the archive's layered structure. At each junction, the intruder had chosen instantly. No probing, no testing, no querying the local topology. Just a decision. Correct every time, taking the optimal path through architecture that Naomi's best mapping algorithms still couldn't fully resolve. She overlaid her own research team's navigation attempts from the past 3 years. The comparison was devastating. Where her team's paths zigzagged, explored, backtracked, made educated guesses, the behavior of intelligent people learning a complex system, the intruders' paths were straight lines. Not straight because they'd found shortcuts. Straight because they already knew the map. The intruder didn't decode the navigation structure, she said aloud. The way she did when she was working through something too complex for internal processing alone. The intruder doesn't need to decode it. This is pre-existing knowledge. Innate knowledge. The kind of knowledge that comes from having built the system. She pulled up the content analysis. What was the intruder reading? Every query, across all 11 events, targeted the same domain. Substrate stabilization protocols. The technology the predecessors had used to maintain their distributed consciousness across their network of structures. The technology that had ultimately failed, that had decayed over 4 billion years until the predecessor patterns dissolved into incoherence, leaving only the archive as testament to what they'd been. Substrate stabilization was consciousness preservation. It was the technology of not dying. Naomi ran the numbers. She'd been running numbers on the predecessor civilization for 7 years, but these numbers were different. These numbers had implications. The predecessor civilization had been distributed, patterns of consciousness encoded in the substrate that connected their 47 structures. The substrate was a medium that operated outside the constraints of normal spacetime, which was why the structures could communicate instantaneously across galactic distances. The predecessors had existed in this medium the way humans existed in physical space. It was their environment, their infrastructure, the thing that held them together. When the substrate began to decay, the predecessors had tried to stabilize it. The archive contained extensive records of their efforts, increasingly desperate attempts to halt a process that was, ultimately, entropic. Irreversible. The substrate degraded. The patterns dissolved. The predecessors died. But, eh. Naomi stared at her display and thought about the word, but, and what it meant when applied to a 4-billion-year-old tragedy. The entity, the thing that had responded when Holden triggered the cascade, had existed in the substrate, not as a predecessor consciousness, as something new. An echo, a pattern formed from the residual fragments of the original civilization, evolved over billions of years into something that didn't know its own origins. The cascade had told it who it was. The entity had responded with recognition, with something that resembled gratitude, and had been processing its own history ever since. 1,200 light years away, vast and slow, and finally, for the first time in 4 billion years, not alone. But the entity was a product of decay. It had formed from fragments, degraded, scattered, unintentional. What if the decay hadn't been complete? What if some fragment of the original predecessor consciousness, not evolved, not transformed, just diminished, had survived in the substrate? Too weak to communicate, too dispersed to cohere, too degraded to do anything except persist? And what if that fragment had enough residual awareness to recognize its own technology, enough presence to interface, briefly, with minds that operated on patterns similar enough to predecessor architecture to be compatible? Human neural patterns, shaped by evolution to process information in ways that were, at the deepest structural level, not entirely different from the way the predecessor substrate processed information. The bridge between alien technology and human neurology had always existed. That was why the constructs in the convergence rooms responded to human observers. That was why Miller's pattern had been compatible with the predecessor substrate. Human minds and predecessor systems weren't the same. They were vastly, incomprehensibly different in scale and complexity, but they shared something, a common logic, a family resemblance in the way they organized information. A fragment of predecessor consciousness, desperate, dying, reaching out through that resemblance, riding human neural patterns for brief moments to access its own archive and search for the one piece of data that might save it. Substrate stabilization, the recipe for not dying. Naomi sat back in her chair and looked at the cold coffee and felt the particular vertigo that came from following a chain of logic to a conclusion that was both inevitable and terrifying. If the predecessors could be reconstituted, if a fragment could access the stabilization data and use it to restore coherence to decayed patterns, what came back wouldn't be a diminished remnant. The stabilization technology was designed for a civilization that had operated on a galactic scale, a civilization that had built the protomolecule, constructed 47 indestructible structures, created a substrate that could carry consciousness across the galaxy. A civilization so far beyond humanity that the gap wasn't measurable in terms humans could comprehend. If the predecessors came back, they wouldn't be humanity's neighbors. They wouldn't be peers. They wouldn't be rivals. They would be something so far above human comprehension that the relationship would be insects and gods. Humanity wouldn't be conquered or enslaved or destroyed. Humanity would be irrelevant, a detail, a footnote in the history of a civilization that had outlived entropy. She thought about Holden, about the argument they'd been having for 20 years in different forms, at different scales. Holden would want to help. Holden always wanted to help. If something was dying and asking for medicine, Holden's instinct, his foundational, unshakable, maddening instinct, was to give it to them. But this wasn't medicine. This was giving a civilization-building toolkit to something that might be a god. Naomi pulled up the query data again, looked at the paths, precise and fluent and desperate. Looked at the target domain, substrate stabilization. Looked at the timestamp data that showed each access event lasting between 30 and 90 minutes, which meant the fragment could only sustain coherence through a human host for brief periods before dissolving back into the substrate noise. It was dying. Whatever this was, it was dying, not dramatically, not violently, just fading. The way the predecessors had faded, 4 billion years ago, except this was the last of them, the final ember, and it was reaching for its own library with borrowed hands because it had nothing else left. Naomi didn't know what to do with that. She was the analyst. She saw the patterns, ran the numbers, mapped the territory. She didn't make the choices. That was Holden's job, and it had always been Holden's job. And she had never envied him the weight of it. She checked the access logs one more time. The 11 events had retrieved approximately 6% of the total substrate stabilization dataset. 6% in 11 attempts across 6 systems. At that rate, assuming the fragment could sustain its current pace of access events, it would take months to retrieve the complete dataset. Maybe longer, if the Transport Union tightened security at archive sites. Maybe shorter if it found more efficient conduits. The math was uncertain because the variables were uncertain, but one thing was clear. It wasn't done. It would keep reaching, keep borrowing, keep riding human neural patterns until it found what it needed or ran out of time. And running out of time, for the last fragment of a 4-billion-year-old civilization, meant something final. There was another number that Naomi ran, quietly, privately, in a partition of her analysis suite that she didn't share with anyone. The archive's deepest layers, the ones the intruder was targeting, contained not just the substrate stabilization protocols, but the integration sequences that would make them functional. The protocols without the integration sequences were like having a blueprint without knowing what building it described. Useful information, but not actionable. She had mapped 73% of the integration sequences. Her research team had been working on them for 3 years, slowly, methodically, with the patient rigor that characterized everything Naomi did. She was closer to understanding predecessor consciousness preservation than any other researcher in the system, which meant she was also closer to understanding what the intruder was looking for. And she was starting to understand something else, something she hadn't told Holden yet, because she wasn't sure how to say it in a way that wouldn't immediately trigger every alarm in his moral nervous system. The 48th voice in the archive. Miller's echo, the human pattern woven into the predecessor fabric, had been behaving differently since the access events began. Not communicating. Miller's pattern was no longer capable of communication in any meaningful sense, but the resonance had changed. A subtle shift in the harmonic signature that she'd been tracking for 7 years. The way you track a heartbeat you know by feel. It was reacting to the intruder. Not responding, reacting. The way an immune system reacts to a pathogen. Or the way a dog reacts to a sound its owner can't hear. She couldn't tell which analogy was correct, and the difference mattered enormously. She saved her analysis, encrypted it, and sent it to Holden's console. Then she reheated her coffee and stared at the display and waited for him to read it, and come down to engineering with the look on his face that meant the universe had asked its question again, and he was trying to figure out what kind of answer wouldn't get everyone killed. She didn't have to wait long. Chapter 5. Holden. The research station at Lakai 8760 was called Outpost Tamara, and it was the kind of place that existed because someone had once said we should study this, and then nobody had thought to ask whether the people doing the studying should be comfortable while they did it. The station was a converted cargo module, a standard 2-shipping container, pressurized and fitted with life support, bolted to a docking frame that clung to the exterior hull of the Kiran Desai like a barnacle on a hull. It had been designed to house 4 researchers for 30-day rotations. It currently housed 11, because the Transport Union's response to the access events had been to flood the affected sites with investigators, forensic analysts, and medical personnel, none of whom had been allocated anywhere to sleep. Holden docked the Rocinante at Outpost Tamara's secondary port, and climbed through the umbilical into a space that smelled like too many people, and not enough air filters. The common area was roughly the size of the Rossi's galley, and was currently serving as a medical examination room, an interview space, and a cafeteria simultaneously. A woman in a 2 medical uniform was eating noodles at a fold-out table while 2 meters away, a forensic analyst was photographing an archive terminal. Captain Holden. The station's acting supervisor was a thin, exhausted-looking man named Chen, who had the expression of someone who had been professional and cooperative for longer than his nervous system could sustain. Thank you for coming. We've prepared the interview subjects. People. Dun wow. In. I'm sorry. They're people. Not interview subjects. Can I talk to Dr. Tanaka first? Chen led him through a corridor that required turning sideways to navigate. The station hadn't been designed for the current population density, to a small room that might have been a storage closet in a previous life, and was now serving as Dr. Yuki Tanaka's quarters. She was sitting on a fold-out bunk, her hands wrapped around a cup of tea that she wasn't drinking, staring at a patch of wall, with the focused blankness of someone who had been staring at it for a long time. She was 43. Holden had read her file on the transit from Sigma Draconis. Archive linguist, 12 years of experience. 3 papers on predecessor notational systems that were considered definitive. She had come to Structure 17 to do the slow, careful work of building an index for an alien library, and instead she'd lost 42 minutes of her life to something that had used her hands to search for its own survival. "Dr. Tanaka, I'm James Holden. I know who you are." Her voice was flat, controlled, the voice of someone who had decided to be calm and was maintaining that decision through sheer discipline. "You triggered the cascade."
"I did. Some people think you saved the species, others think you're reckless, a few think you're both. All three are probably right. Can you tell me what happened?"
She told him. It was the same account he'd read in the initial report. The late shift, the frequency analysis, the sudden discontinuity in her timeline, waking up at the restricted terminal with 42 minutes missing and predecessor equations on the screen. But hearing it from her, sitting in a room small enough that he could have reached out and touched both walls, was different from reading it. The report was data. The woman was a person who had been violated in a way that didn't have a precedent or a vocabulary. "The equations," Holden said. "Have they been analyzed?"
"Your wife? Partner? Sorry.
Dr. Nagata's team has the data. The equations are substrate stabilization protocols. Consciousness preservation technology. The thing that would have saved the predecessors if they'd figured it out in time." Tanaka's hands tightened around her teacup. "Whoever used me knew exactly what they were looking for, and exactly where to find it."
"When you say used you,
I mean used. Like a tool, like a terminal. Like a piece of equipment that happens to have hands and eyes and a security clearance." The controlled voice cracked slightly. "I have a PhD in archive linguistics. I've spent 12 years learning to read predecessor notation at a basic level. Whatever was inside my head for those 42 minutes didn't need to learn. It already knew. I was the interface, the keyboard. The thing it typed on." Holden let the silence hold. He'd learned, over 20 years of interviews and conversations and the particular kind of human interaction that happened when people were scared, that silence was more useful than questions. People filled silences with the things they needed to say, which were usually different from the things you thought to ask.
"There's something else," Tanaka said. "Something I didn't put in the report."
Holden waited. "When I came back, when I was myself again, there was a moment, less than a second, where I was still connected to whatever had been using me. Not controlled. Connected. Like being in the same room with someone as they're leaving. And I felt..." She stopped. Took a breath. "I felt how old it was. Not as information. As a sensation. The way you feel cold or pressure. Age like geology. Layers and layers and layers and layers of time. Compressed. Eroded. Barely coherent." It wasn't thinking. Not in any way I'd recognize as thought. It was just reaching, the way a plant reaches for light. Reflexive. Desperate. Unaware that it was desperate because awareness requires more coherence than it had. "You felt it dying."
"I felt it barely existing. Dying implies a process. This was more like a condition. Like being alive was a thing it was doing with enormous effort, moment to moment. And the effort was getting harder."
Holden sat in the storage closet that was serving as a researcher's quarters on a station that was serving as a crisis center, orbiting a structure that was serving as a library, built by a civilization that had been serving as evidence that the universe was stranger than anyone wanted it to be. And he thought about what Naomi's analysis had said and what this woman's experience confirmed, and what it all added up.
Something was dying. Not dramatically, not violently, fading. The last fragment of a 4-billion-year-old civilization, reaching through human minds for the one thing that might save it. And it hadn't asked. It hadn't communicated. It had just taken. The way a drowning person grabs whatever's closest without thinking about whether they're pulling someone else under.
"Dr. Tanaka, I need to ask you something, and I need an honest answer." She looked at him. Her eyes were steady, the eyes of a scientist who dealt in evidence and had just experienced something that didn't fit any evidentiary framework she possessed.
"If it happens again, if something reaches through and uses you again, what do you want me to do?"
The question surprised her. He could see it in the slight shift of her expression, the recalibration from prepared for questions to unprepared for this one.
"Nobody's asked me that," she said.
"I'm asking."
She thought about it, really thought, the way scientists think, testing the question from multiple angles, checking the assumptions, looking for hidden variables.
"I want to understand it," she said finally. "I want to know what it is, and I want it to stop using people without their consent.
those two things might be contradictory. I haven't figured out how to resolve them yet.
If it helps, Holden said, neither have I.
He thanked her and left the room and walked back through the corridor sideways and stood in the common area where the forensic analyst was still photographing the terminal and the medical officer was still eating noodles, and everything was simultaneously normal and profoundly not.
Then Dr. Tanaka screamed.
Holden was back through the corridor before he'd finished deciding to move. He found her standing at the small desk in her quarters, her body rigid, her eyes open but vacant, her hands moving across the desk's surface in precise, fluid motions that bore no relationship to anything a human being would naturally do. Her fingers traced patterns, predecessor notation, angular and recursive, drawn in the air above the desk surface with the focused concentration of someone who could see something that wasn't visible to anyone else. It lasted 90 seconds. Holden watched. He didn't interfere, because he didn't know how to interfere, and because some part of him, the part that had touched a predecessor construct and triggered a cascade, and listened to the entity's first pulse of recognition, understood that interfering might be worse than watching. Dr. Tanaka's hands stopped moving. Her eyes refocused. She looked at Holden, then at her hands, then at the desk, where the motions had left no marks because she'd been writing on a surface that couldn't record them.
90 seconds, Holden said quietly.
Was it an...
Yes, you were writing. Predecessor notation. In the air.
Tanaka sat down on the bunk. Her hands were shaking now. She looked at them the way you look at something that has betrayed you.
I was awake, she said, partially. I could feel it. Not see, not hear, feel.
It's so tired, Captain Holden.
Whatever it is.
It's so unimaginably tired.
Holden nodded. He didn't say what he was thinking, which was that tired and desperate was the most dangerous combination in the universe, and that the entity's exhaustion didn't make it safe, and that a drowning person's need for air didn't obligate anyone to dive into the water after.
He thought it, though. He thought it all the way back to the Rossi, where Naomi was waiting with the analysis that confirmed what he already knew. The intruder was the last trace of the predecessors, and it was dying, and it was searching for a way not to, and nobody in the entire human species had the slightest idea what to do about it.
Except Holden had an idea. He'd always had an idea. The same idea he'd had since the first time the universe had dropped something impossible in his lap, and asked him to deal with it.
Tell the truth, help the dying, and hope that being good was enough.
It never had been. He kept trying anyway.
Chapter 6. Ren died. The second time was different because Ren was awake for part of it. He was in the Korematsu's engineering bay, running a diagnostic on the port thruster coupling that had been making a sound he didn't like, a high-frequency whine at the upper edge of human hearing, the kind of sound that meant a bearing was beginning to fail, and would fail completely at the least convenient moment, which was the only moment things ever failed.
Not blur exactly, soften, like someone was slowly adjusting the focus on a lens, pulling the sharp edges of reality into something smoother, less defined.
The engineering bay didn't change. The tools were still on the workbench. The diagnostic display was still showing thruster telemetry. The recycler he'd fixed last week was still humming in its housing. But it all began to feel less solid, less present, like the difference between looking at something and looking at a photograph of something.
Ren put down the torque wrench. He knew what was happening. He'd known since Relay Station 14. Since the 40 minutes that didn't exist, since he'd woken up with predecessor equations in his handwriting on a terminal he'd never walked to. He'd spent 3 days since then waiting for it to happen again, and the waiting had been almost worse than the event itself because at least the event had been finite.
No, he said, to no one, to the empty engineering bay, to whatever was reaching through the space between the archive substrate and his nervous system. Not again. I don't.
He didn't finish the sentence.
The transition was faster this time. The engineering bay receded, not disappeared, not vanished, just receded, the way the shore recedes when you wade into deep water. It was still there. He could still see it, distantly, through whatever he was becoming. The tools on the workbench, the diagnostic display, the torque wrench he'd set down, all of it present but irrelevant, like scenery through a window on a moving train. And behind it, behind reality, beneath it, woven through it like thread through fabric, was the substrate. Ren had heard his mother describe the predecessor substrate 100 times. She'd used words like medium and architecture and information topology, and he'd understood them the way you understand a foreign language you've heard spoken but never studied, recognizing individual words without grasping the grammar. But understanding a description of water was nothing like drowning in it. The substrate was vast. Not vast the way space was vast, not empty, not dark, not defined by the absence of things. Vast the way a city is vast, or a forest, or a nervous system. Full of structure, full of pathways, full of connections that branched and merged and folded back on themselves in patterns that his visual cortex tried to interpret as geometry and failed because the geometry had too many dimensions. And it was old. Old the way mountains were old, the way ocean floors were old, the way the core of a planet was old. Not as information, but as a physical sensation, a weight that pressed against his awareness from every direction simultaneously. 4 billion years of accumulated structure, layer upon layer, each one bearing the impression of a consciousness that had existed there, had thought there, had lived, and died, and left its mark. He was riding behind his own eyes. That was the only way he could describe it. His body was moving. He could feel it, distantly. The way you feel your legs moving when you're half asleep. But the movements weren't his. His hands were reaching for something that wasn't in the engineering bay. His fingers were tracing patterns in the air, predecessor notation, and the movements felt wrong in a way that had nothing to do with unfamiliarity. They felt wrong because they were precise, more precise than his hands had ever been. Whatever was using his motor cortex was using it better than he did. And through the substrate, through the vast, ancient, dying architecture of a civilization that had existed for longer than multicellular life had existed on Earth, he could feel the intruder. Not see, feel. The way you feel someone standing behind you in a dark room. A presence, distributed across the substrate like dust in a beam of light, scattered, fragmentary, barely coherent. Not a mind, not a consciousness, not a person in any way Ren could recognize as a person. Just a pattern. A pattern that had once been part of something enormous, and was now almost nothing, holding itself together through an effort so sustained and so desperate that the effort itself had become the pattern. It was reaching, through Ren, through his nervous system, through his hands, it was reaching for the archive, for its own library, for the data that had been recorded by the civilization it had once been part of, encoded in structures it had once helped maintain, written in a language it still remembered, even though it had forgotten everything else, forgotten its name, its history, its nature, its kind. All of that was gone, eroded by 4 billion years of decay. And what remained was a reflex, a reaching. A hand in the dark, grasping for something it knew was there, because the hand remembered even when the mind did not. Ren felt its loneliness, not as an emotion. The fragment wasn't capable of emotion, not in its current state, as a condition, as the fundamental characteristic of an existence that had been alone for so long, that aloneness had become indistinguishable from identity. The entity, the echo of the predecessors that Holden had contacted through the cascade, had been lonely too, but the entity was vast, coherent, alive in its own alien way. This fragment was none of those things. This was the last spark of a fire that had burned for 4 billion years, guttering in a wind it couldn't feel, reaching for fuel it couldn't hold. Ren wanted to help it. The feeling surprised him. He was terrified. He was being used, controlled, operated like a machine. And underneath the terror was something else, something that responded to the fragment's desperation the way his hands responded to a broken coupling. Fix it. Help it. Make it work. The fragment reached through him for 63 seconds. He was aware for perhaps 40 of them. The rest was the familiar nothing, the clean edit, the missing time, the surgical removal of experience from memory. When he came back, he was sitting on the engineering bay floor. His hands were in his lap. The diagnostic display was still running. The torque wrench was where he'd left it. Nothing in the room had changed. Everything in the room had changed. He couldn't explain what he'd seen, not because it was inexpressible, though it was, but because the vocabulary didn't exist. Human languages had evolved to describe human experiences, and what Ren had experienced was as far from human as the bottom of an ocean trench was from the surface. He'd seen, felt, glimpsed. Something that existed in a medium humanity didn't have words for. Experienced through senses humanity didn't have names for. Perceiving structures that humanity didn't have geometry for. What he could say was this. The fragment was real. The fragment was dying. The fragment was the predecessors. Not all of them, not even a meaningful fraction of them, but a fragment of the original, undeniable and unmistakable. The way a single bone is undeniably part of a skeleton. And it was reaching for a way to survive. Not consciously, not deliberately. Just reaching the way a vine reaches for light. Because reaching was the last thing it remembered how to do. He called his mother. For the first time in 3 weeks, he called his mother. She answered on the second ring. Her face filled the comm screen. Dr. Maria Vasquez Chen, lead researcher, foremost expert. A woman who had spent her career studying the predecessor archive, and who was about to learn that the archive was studying her son. Ren, you look terrible.
Mom, something happened. Something is happening. I need to tell you about it, and I need you to not be a scientist about it for 5 minutes. She couldn't do that, of course. She was a scientist about everything, the way Ren was an engineer about everything. But she listened. And when he was done, when he'd told her about Relay 14, and the missing time and the equations in his handwriting, and the 63 seconds in the engineering bay, and the vast dying architecture of something that had been alive for longer than the concept of alive had existed, she was quiet for a long time.
It chose you, she said finally.
I don't think it chooses. I think it reaches for whatever's closest, whatever's compatible.
You're compatible because of me. Her voice was careful, measured, the voice of a woman who had just realized that her life's work had implications she hadn't anticipated. The substrate interface protocols I helped develop, the ones that made the convergence room constructs work, they established that certain neural architectures are more compatible with predecessor systems than others.
Mine is, which means yours might be.
Might be. The compatibility is partially hereditary. We've known that since the cascade data. I published a paper on it. She paused. I didn't think it mattered. I didn't think there was anything left in the substrate to be compatible with.
Ren looked at his hands. Steady. Always steady. Even now.
There is, he said. And it's dying. And it's using me to try not to. His mother's expression was the most complicated thing Ren had ever seen. Scientist and parent, curiosity and terror, the desire to understand and the desire to protect. All of it layered on top of each other like the substrate itself. Too many dimensions for a single face to contain.
Come home, she said.
He didn't know if he could. He didn't know if it mattered. Whatever was reaching through the substrate for the archive stabilization data, it had found him once at Relay 14, and once on the Korematsu, and it would find him again, because the gap between the archive and his nervous system wasn't a gap at all. It was a door, and something on the other side had learned how to open it. Chapter 7. Drummer, Dardim. The 72 hours of compliance lasted 41. Drummer got the alert while she was eating breakfast, an act she performed standing up, at her desk, reading reports, because sitting down for breakfast implied a level of leisure that she hadn't experienced since she'd accepted the presidency, and probably wouldn't experience again until she resigned or died, whichever came first. The alert was from Two Naval Command. The Earth Coalition had deployed a carrier group to the Tau Ceti structure site without transport union authorization. 12 ships, including the destroyer Ganges and the cruiser New Delhi, taking up positions around Structure 23, with their weapon systems active. She put down her breakfast. It was the last time she thought about food for 16 hours. Get me Chen Wei on a secure channel, she told her comm officer. And get me Admiral Souza. And get me whoever the Mars Congressional Republic is pretending speaks for them this week. Wei answered first. His face on the screen had the carefully constructed neutrality of a diplomat who knew he'd been caught and was deciding how much to admit. President Drummer, I assume this is about the Tau Ceti deployment.
You assumed correctly. 12 ships at Structure 23.
Weapons active. Without two authorization. Which part of no unilateral military action was unclear. The Earth Coalition considers the archive access events a security threat of the highest order. Our assessment is that the Transport Union's investigative timeline is insufficient to...
Ow.
Your assessment. Drummer's voice was flat. Not angry. Flat was worse than angry, and Wei knew it. Your assessment is that you can ignore the authority of the organization that manages every trade route, docking protocol, and communications, relay in the system, because you've decided you know better. The conduits, the people being used by this intruder, include 3 Earth citizens. We have an obligation to protect our people.
By deploying warships to an alien structure site. What's the plan, Wei?
Shoot the archive. Torpedo a building that survived a nuclear strike without a scratch. Your military can't hurt the structure, and you know it.
So either this is a show of force aimed at other factions, in which case you're escalating a political crisis during an alien contact event, or you actually believe you can contain something that operates through human neural pathways by pointing guns at a rock.
Which is it?
Wei's neutrality cracked slightly. We want to capture a conduit during an active episode, study the interface, understand the mechanism. If we can understand how the intruder operates through human hosts, we can develop countermeasures.
You want to trap a person during a possession event and experiment on them.
Study, not experiment. The difference is institutional, not moral.
Drummer cut the channel. She'd made her point.
Wei would relay it to the Earth Coalition leadership, who would ignore it, because the Earth Coalition had been ignoring Belt Authority since before Drummer was born, and the habit was hardwired into their institutional DNA.
Admiral Souza, the TU's senior naval officer, was already on the second screen. She was a compact woman in her 50s with the particular posture of someone who had commanded warships and never entirely stopped.
Options, Drummer said. Limited. We have 11 Tau vessels in the Tau Ceti corridor. The Earther carrier group outguns us 3-1. We can position for observation and obstruction. Put our ships between the Earthers and the structure. But if they decide to push through, we can't stop them without a firefight.
I'm not starting a shooting war over a research site.
Then our options are diplomatic.
Diplomatic meaning I yell at Wei until he agrees to pull back.
Essentially. Drummer pulled up the system-wide disposition map. The Tau Ceti deployment was the most visible provocation, but it wasn't the only one. Mars had positioned 2 destroyers at the Epsilon Eridani structure, ostensibly on routine patrol, officially unrelated to the access events, and absolutely nobody believed either claim. 3 Belt militia ships were loitering near Structure 11, which was in a nominally neutral zone but had been the site of 2 access events. Everyone was maneuvering. Everyone was positioning. Everyone was treating the structures like territory to be controlled, because that was what factions did when something valuable appeared. They fought over who got to control it. The irony was so thick she could taste it. The predecessor archive had been designed as an open system, non-exclusive access. Knowledge for everyone. The cascade had been triggered specifically to prevent any faction from monopolizing the archive. And here they were, 7 years later, factions deploying warships to archive sites because something was accessing the archive in ways they didn't understand, and their first instinct, their deepest, most reflexive instinct, was to claim ownership of the problem. Drummer's descom chimed. The Martian representative. She took the call.
President Drummer. The Martian Congressional Republic formally protests the Earth Coalition's unauthorized deployment to Tau Ceti and requests that the Transport Union enforce its stated policy of no unilateral military action. The MECR wants me to enforce the policy while the MECR has 2 destroyers at Epsilon Eridani in violation of the same policy.
Silence. The Martian representative was very good at silence. It was a Martian diplomatic skill, the ability to say nothing in a way that implied everything.
Pull your ships back from Eridani, Drummer said. Then I'll deal with Earth at Tau Ceti. Then the Belt Militia at 11. Everyone backs off or no one backs off. I'm not playing favorites.
The MECR's deployment is defensive.
I don't care what it is. Pull back or don't. But if you don't, you've lost the standing to complain about Earth.
She cut the channel. Then she stood at her desk in her office on Medina Station and looked at the system map with its clusters of warships around ancient alien structures and thought about how consistently, how reliably, how predictably human beings responded to the unknown by trying to own it. The archive wasn't a resource. It was a library. The structures weren't territory. They were monuments. The intruder wasn't an enemy. It was, maybe, the last trace of a civilization that had died before multicellular life existed on Earth. But none of that mattered to factions that saw power in every equation and threat in every unknown. The intruder was accessing data that might contain technology beyond human comprehension. Technology of consciousness preservation. Technology of persistence. Technology that, in the wrong hands, in any hands possibly, could reshape the balance of power in the system permanently. Whoever understood the substrate stabilization protocols first would understand the mechanism by which consciousness could be maintained indefinitely.
The implications went beyond military advantage. They went beyond political power. They touched something fundamental, the barrier between life and death, the limit that defined what it meant to be mortal, the thing that everyone feared, and no one admitted fearing, and entire civilizations had organized themselves around avoiding. The predecessors had cracked that barrier. They'd maintained consciousness for 4 billion years. The fact that their technology had eventually failed didn't diminish the achievement, it just meant the technology needed improvement. And the archive, 4 billion years of accumulated knowledge, might contain the information needed to make the improvement. That was what the faction saw. Not a dying fragment reaching for its own survival. A prize. Drummer sat down. She did not eat breakfast. She called 17 people in the next 4 hours, each call shorter and more pointed than the last, and by the end of the day she had extracted grudging agreements from Earth, Mars, and 3 Belt coalitions to maintain the 2's jurisdictional authority over archive sites for another 30 days. Not because any of them respected the authority, because each of them feared the others gaining unilateral access more than they resented Drummer's interference. Fear is governance. It worked. It always worked. Drummer hated it every time. She went home at 2300, home being a quarters on Medina Station that she occupied but had never decorated, and stood in the shower for 15 minutes and thought about the intruder. Something that had been part of a civilization for 4 billion years, reduced to a fragment, reaching through human minds for its own survival. It hadn't asked permission. It hadn't communicated its intent. It hadn't done any of the things that would have made Drummer's response straightforward. If it had asked, she might have helped. She understood desperation. She'd grown up in it. The belt was built on desperation. The desperate need for air, for water, for infrastructure, for the basic machinery of survival. She'd spent her life building systems that ensured desperate people got what they needed without having to beg for it. But the intruder hadn't asked. It had taken. And taking, using people as tools, operating their bodies without consent, treating human beings as mechanisms, was the one thing Drummer couldn't forgive. Not because it was malicious. Because it was familiar. Earthers had treated belters as mechanisms for centuries. The powerful had always used the powerless as tools. The intruder's methods were different in scale but identical in principle. You don't get to use people. Not even if you're dying. Not even if you're 4 billion years old. Not even if you're the last of your kind. Drummer turned off the shower. She had 30 days, probably less. Chapter 8. Naomi.0. The data the intruder was accessing had a shape, and the shape was a map. Naomi had been building the map for 3 days, cross-referencing the 11 access events with the archive substrate topology. And what emerged wasn't random. It wasn't scattered. It was systematic. A retrieval pattern that, when plotted across the archive's organizational structure, traced a single coherent path through the substrate stabilization domain. The intruder wasn't grabbing data indiscriminately. It was following a sequence, a curriculum. As if it were reading a textbook from the first page, methodically, chapter by chapter, building comprehension in a specific order. The order was significant because it told her what the intruder already knew and what it didn't. The early access events had targeted foundational protocols, the basic principles of substrate maintenance, the physics of consciousness persistence, the theoretical framework that underlay the entire stabilization system. The later events had moved into implementation specifics, engineering details, calibration sequences, operational parameters. The progression was pedagogical. Someone, something, was teaching itself how its own technology worked, starting from first principles and building up. Which meant the intruder had lost that knowledge. It had once understood substrate stabilization innately, had been part of a civilization that used it as naturally as humans used oxygen. And now it was relearning from its own textbook, because the knowledge had decayed along with everything else. Naomi found that detail more unsettling than anything else in the access logs. A being so degraded it had forgotten how its own survival mechanisms worked, reaching through alien minds to relearn from a library it had helped create. The desperation wasn't abstract anymore. It was specific, granular. A student cramming for an exam where failure meant extinction. She mapped the retrieval sequence against the complete substrate stabilization dataset, the full body of knowledge the archive contained on consciousness preservation technology. The 11 access events had retrieved approximately 6% of the total. At the current rate, complete retrieval would take 183 additional access events spread across an estimated 4 to 7 months. But that number was misleading. The dataset wasn't linear. It was hierarchical, with foundational concepts supporting increasingly complex implementation details. The intruder had completed the foundational layer and was entering the implementation phase. Implementation required more data per concept. The access events would need to be longer, more frequent, or both. More time inside human minds, more people used as interfaces, more conduits. Naomi pulled up the conduit data. 11 people had been used across 6 systems. The medical scans showed the same altered neural pattern in all of them. A temporary reorganization of activity in the temporal and parietal lobes that didn't match any known pathology. The pattern was consistent, repeatable, and apparently harmless. No lasting neurological effects, no cognitive impairment, no physical damage. Except. Naomi looked at the data she'd received from the Rossi's visit to the Kiran Desai, Dr. Tanaka's second episode, the 92nd event that Holden had witnessed. The medical scan from that event showed the same altered pattern, but stronger. More defined, as if the neural pathway the intruder used to interface with Tanaka's brain had been widened by use. She cross-referenced with the other conduits. 3 of the 11 had experienced second events. All 3 showed the same widening. The intruder was wearing grooves in their neural pathways. Not damaging them. Optimizing them. Making itself a better fit each time, the way a key wears into a lock. The implications were uncomfortable. If the intruder kept using the same conduits, the interface would become easier. More efficient. Longer duration. Less effort. More data retrieved per event. The conduits would become preferred pathways. Not just compatible humans, but tuned instruments. Tools that had been shaped to fit the hand that used them. And the conduits wouldn't know. They'd lose time. 40 minutes, 90 seconds, whatever the duration. They'd wake up confused and frightened, and then they'd get on with their lives until it happened again. And again. And again, each time easier for the intruder, each time the grooves a little deeper. Naomi thought about Ren Vasquez. She'd read his mother's research on neural compatibility, Maria Vasquez Chen's papers on hereditary substrate interface predisposition. The trait that made some human neural architectures more compatible with predecessor systems than others was partially genetic. Maria had it. Her son might have it. If the intruder found Ren, found that compatibility, found a conduit whose neural architecture was already predisposed toward the predecessor substrate, he'd become the preferred tool. The best fitting key, the interface that required the least effort and yielded the most data. She pulled up the substrate stabilization dataset one more time, looked at the 6% already retrieved, looked at the 94% remaining, looked at the implementation layer the intruder was entering, the complex, data-heavy protocols that would require sustained access events of increasing duration. Then she looked at what the data actually described. Substrate stabilization wasn't just maintenance. It wasn't just keeping existing patterns coherent. At its deepest level, the technology described how to reconstruct degraded patterns from partial data. How to take a fragment, a dying ember of consciousness, scattered across the substrate like dust in a beam of light, and rebuild it. Restore it. Bring it back. The predecessors hadn't just maintained their minds for 4 billion years. They'd developed the technology to reconstruct them if they failed. The stabilization protocols were, at their core, a resurrection system. A way to rebuild a consciousness from its own ruins. The intruder wasn't just trying not to die, it was trying to come back. Naomi sat in the engineering bay and felt the particular vertigo that came from following a chain of logic past the point where the conclusions were comfortable and into the territory where they were merely true. If the intruder succeeded, if it retrieved a complete stabilization dataset, including the integration sequences that would make the protocols functional, it could theoretically reconstruct itself, not as a fragment, not as a dying ember, as a full predecessor consciousness, or something close to it, something with the knowledge and capability of a civilization that had built ring gates and protomolecule, and 47 indestructible structures, and had reshaped the galaxy to suit its needs. Humanity had inherited the archive. Humanity was learning from it. In 7 years, the decoded portions of the archive had advanced human technology by decades. New materials, new physics, new mathematics. And that was from 12% of the surface layers. A restored predecessor consciousness would have access to the complete archive. Not as a student, as the author. Every piece of knowledge, every technique, every capability that the predecessor civilization had accumulated over millions of years of existence, available instantly to a mind designed to use it. The math was simple and terrifying. Humanity's current technological capability, plotted against the full scope of the predecessor archive, occupied a space so small, it was essentially zero. The gap between humanity and a restored predecessor wasn't the gap between a child and an adult. It was the gap between a bacterium and a human. Not an enemy. Not a rival. An entirely different category of existence. Naomi saved her analysis. She did not encrypt it. She did not send it only to Holden. She sent it to the full research team, to the Transport Union Science Directorate, and to the three people on Medina Station, whose opinions she trusted, because the analysis contained information that was too important to be controlled, and too dangerous to be hidden. And she'd spent 7 years watching Holden make exactly this choice. Truth over safety, transparency over control. And she'd learned that he was usually right, even when being right. Then she went to find Holden, because the analysis raised a question that Data couldn't answer. If something is dying and the medicine that saves it might end you, do you hand it over? Chapter 9. Holden. The argument happened in the galley because the galley was where the Rossi's crew had always had their arguments, and some things were too important to change. Naomi had sent him the analysis, the full analysis, unencrypted, distributed to the research team and the two science directorate and anyone else she trusted. He'd read it twice. Then he'd gone to the galley and made coffee for four because making coffee was what Holden did when he needed time to think and didn't want to admit he needed time to think. Alex arrived first, because Alex always arrived first when there was coffee. Then Amos, who didn't drink coffee but came anyway because the galley was where the crew talked, and not being there was a statement Amos never made. Naomi came last, carrying her hand terminal with the analysis still open on the screen, the way a lawyer carries a brief to court. "I've read it," Holden said. He set four cups on the table, three with coffee, one with water for Amos. "You think the intruder is a predecessor fragment. You think it's dying. You think it's searching for substrate stabilization protocols that would allow it to reconstruct itself. And you think a reconstructed predecessor would be so far beyond human capability that we'd be irrelevant. That's the summary. I have a simpler summary. Something's dying and it needs help. That's not simpler. That's incomplete. It's the part that matters." Naomi set her terminal on the table. The display showed the substrate topology map with the access events highlighted, red traces converging on the stabilization data like blood vessels converging on a heart. "What matters, Holden, is what happens after. If we help the intruder and it succeeds, we're not helping a person. We're restoring a civilization. A civilization that operated on a scale we can't comprehend. A civilization that built the protomolecule. The protomolecule was a tool. The predecessors used it the way we use. The protomolecule killed millions of people on Eros. The galley was quiet. The recycler hummed. The coffee cooled. That wasn't the predecessors," Holden said. "That was humans misusing predecessor technology. The predecessors didn't deploy the protomolecule against us. We found it. We weaponized it. That's on us. And when a restored predecessor has access to the same technology, when something that built the protomolecule in the first place decides it needs to use it again, we're not talking about a fragment, Holden. We're talking about something that could reshape the galaxy. They did it once. What stops them from doing it again? Maybe they won't want to. Maybe they won't notice us enough to want anything about us." Holden looked at his coffee. It was too hot to drink and exactly the right temperature for staring at while he tried to organize thoughts that didn't want to be organized. He'd been here before. Not this exact argument, but this exact shape of argument. When the derelict was discovered and Archway Systems wanted to keep it secret, Holden had broadcast everything. When the cascade was ready and Admiral Carr wanted to prevent it, Holden had triggered it. Every time the universe presented him with a choice between safety and truth, between caution and action, between protecting humanity from knowledge and trusting humanity with it, he'd chosen the same way. But those choices had been about information. About broadcasting what was true. This was different. This was about giving something to an alien consciousness that might use it to become more powerful than anything humanity had ever encountered. "Amos," Holden said, "what do you think?" Amos took a drink of water. His face was calm. Amos's face was always calm, in the way that a wall is calm. If it can use people like that, take them over, drive them around, use their hands, what stops it from using everyone, all the time?
Maybe it can't, Alex said. Maybe it's too weak. Too fragmented. Maybe it can only manage brief windows because sustaining coherence through a human host takes more energy than it has.
It's weak now. Amos set down his water glass. That's the point, right? Right now it's weak and desperate, and it's only using people for a few minutes at a time. What happens when it's strong? When it's got the stabilization data, and it's reconstituted, and it's not desperate anymore? Does it stop using people? Or does it keep going because it can?
We don't know, Naomi said.
That's what I'm saying, we don't know. And the thing about not knowing is that it cuts both ways. Maybe it's harmless. Maybe it's grateful. Maybe it reconstitutes, and it's the best neighbor in the galaxy. Or maybe it reconstitutes and we're bacteria on a countertop and it doesn't even see us when it wipes us away. The galley was quiet again. Amos had a gift for silence, for making silence carry weight, for letting the absence of words do the work that words couldn't.
Alex? Holden said.
Alex leaned back in his chair, the way he leaned back in the pilot's seat when he was running calculations in his head.
I keep thinking about Miller. He was a pattern.
A dead man's consciousness preserved in data networks, operating in a medium that wasn't designed for human minds. And he was still Miller. Still stubborn, still ethical, still doing the right thing even when the right thing cost him everything. The medium didn't change who he was, it just changed what he could do.
You're saying the predecessors would still be the predecessors.
I'm saying the entity, the big one 1,200 light years away, responded to the cascade with recognition and gratitude. Not hostility, not aggression. It learned what it was, and it was grateful to know. That's not the behavior of something that wants to hurt us.
The entity isn't the fragment, Naomi said.
The entity evolved. It spent 4 billion years becoming something new. The fragment didn't evolve. The fragment is original predecessor consciousness. Degraded, diminished, but original. We don't know what the originals were like. We know what they built. We know they were powerful enough to reshape the galaxy. We don't know if they were kind.
Nobody knows if they were kind, Holden said.
Nobody knows if we're kind. Kindness isn't a characteristic of species. It's a choice individuals make. Individuals who might be so far beyond us they don't recognize us as individuals. The coffee was cold. Holden drank it anyway because wasting coffee was a thing he refused to do on principle.
Naomi, if we don't help, if we block the intruder, lock down the archive, prevent it from accessing the stabilization data, what happens?
It dies. The last fragment of the predecessor civilization fades. We keep the archive but lose the authors. The entity gets its reply in 1,200 years and finds out that the last trace of its origin died while humanity watched.
And if we help?
Something comes back that we can't predict, can't control, and can't contain. Something that might be wonderful or might be catastrophic, and we have absolutely no way to know which until it happens. So the choice is, let something die because we're afraid of what saving it might mean, or save something and accept the risk.
That's not a fair framing.
It's my framing. It's the only framing I know how to use.
Naomi looked at him across the galley table, across 20 years of partnership and argument, and the particular intimacy of people who had made each other better and worse in equal measure.
I know it is. That's what scares me.
I'm not deciding anything right now, Holden said. I'm not broadcasting anything. I'm not touching anything. I'm asking questions and I'm listening to answers and I'm trying to figure out what kind of species we want to be when we look back at this moment.
The kind that survived, Amos said.
The kind that did the right thing, Holden said.
Those might not be the same thing, Naomi said.
They never are.
That's why it matters which one we pick.
The Rossi flew on through the dark between stars, carrying 4 people who didn't agree, and a question that didn't have an answer, and the accumulated weight of every choice they'd ever made pressing down on the one they hadn't made yet.
Chapter 10. Ren died.
The third time, the intruder left something behind. Ren was on Tycho Station by then. His mother had pulled strings, called in favors, done whatever it was that senior researchers did when they needed their children extracted from cargo haulers, and deposited in facilities with actual medical equipment. The Korematsu's Captain Okoye had released him from his contract without argument, which told Ren more about how scared she was than anything she'd actually said.
Tycho Station's medical wing had a neurological monitoring suite that could track individual neural pathways in real time. Maria Vasquez Shen had arranged for Ren to be connected to it 24 hours a day. A constellation of sensors adhered to his scalp and temples that made him look like a man slowly being assimilated by his own medical equipment. The sensors itched. The wires snagged on doorframes. The monitoring technician, a patient woman named Kowalski, who had clearly dealt with worse patients, told him he'd stop noticing after a few days. He hadn't stopped noticing. He was in the station's common area, eating actual food for the first time in weeks. Tycho's galley was three orders of magnitude better than the Korematsu's protein bar supply chain, when the edges went soft again. He recognized it now. The softening. The slight defocusing of reality. As if the universe were changing channels and the picture was briefly between stations. Last time, he'd had 90 seconds of awareness before the nothing took over. This time, he was determined to hold on longer. The common area receded. The noise of the station, conversations, ventilation, the distant thrum of the spin gravity systems, faded to a murmur, then to silence, then to something beneath silence. The substrate opened around him like a flower unfolding, vast and dark and structured and impossibly, terrifyingly old. He held on. Through the defocusing, through the receding, through the transition from here to there, Ren Vasquez held on to himself the way you hold on to a rope in a current. Not with strength, but with stubbornness, with the mechanical determination of a man whose entire professional life had been about maintaining systems under stress. He could feel the intruder, not as a presence, as an absence. A hole in the substrate where something should be, shaped by 4 billion years of existence, defined by what had been lost rather than what remained. It was like feeling the impression left by a river that had dried up. The banks still there, the channel still carved into the landscape, but the water gone. The intruder was the channel. The shape of something vast, filled with almost nothing. And it was reaching through him again. He could feel his hands moving, distantly, on the other side of the divide between where he was and where his body was. The monitoring sensors on his scalp would be recording everything. The altered neural pattern, the reorganization of his temporal and parietal lobes, the widening pathways that the intruder had carved in his brain on previous visits. His mother's colleagues would be watching the data in real time, recording the first monitored conduit event in history. But Ren wasn't watching the data. He was watching the intruder. It moved through the substrate the way Ren moved through a ship's engineering spaces, with the bone-deep familiarity of someone who had built the thing they were navigating. It didn't search. It didn't explore. It went directly to where it needed to go, down through the substrate's layered architecture to the data clusters where the stabilization protocols were stored, and it began to read. Read wasn't quite right. It absorbed. The data flowed into the channel-shaped absence that was the intruder and filled it. Briefly, the way water fills a depression in stone. For a moment, a fraction of a moment, the fragment was more than it had been. Not whole. Not coherent. But less empty. The data gave its substance the way food gives a starving body substance. Not enough to restore, but enough to sustain. And in that moment of slightly less emptiness, the intruder did something it hadn't done before. It noticed Ren. Not the way a person notices another person. Not with awareness or intention or recognition. More the way a blind man's hand encounters an unexpected shape in a familiar space. A moment of contact. An impression. A brief exchange of information that was too fragmentary to qualify as communication. But too specific to be accidental. Ren felt it as a pulse. A single beat of something that wasn't sound. Wasn't light, wasn't any sensation he had a word for. It came from the intruder and passed through him, and left behind an impression. Not a message, not an image, not a thought. An emotion. Loneliness. Not human loneliness. Not the loneliness of a person in an empty room or a traveler far from home. A loneliness so vast and so old that it had geological weight. A loneliness measured not in years or decades but in eons. In epochs, in the slow rotation of galaxies around their centers. A loneliness that had existed for so long it had become structural, load-bearing, foundational, the thing around which everything else was organized, because everything else had fallen away, and only the loneliness remained. Ren understood in that moment what the intruder was. Not intellectually. His mother's research had already given him the intellectual framework. Emotionally. Viscerally. In the way that mattered. It was the last of its kind. The absolute last. Not the last of a species, the way a conservation biologist might mean it. The last of a form of existence. The last consciousness of a type that had existed for 4 billion years and would never exist again if this fragment dissolved. The predecessors were gone. The entity, the vast echo 1,200 light-years away, was something new, something evolved, not the same thing. This fragment was the original. Diminished, degraded, barely functional, but original. The last page of a book that was being erased word by word, fighting to remain legible. And it was lonely. It was lonely the way a fundamental constant is constant. Not as a condition that could change, but as a defining characteristic. Loneliness was what it was made of now. Loneliness and reaching and the fading memory of having once been part of something so large and so beautiful that even the memory of it was too much for what remained to hold. The pulse ended. The impression faded. The intruder went back to its reading, absorbing stabilization data through Ren's hijacked neural pathways with the desperate efficiency of someone who knows the library is closing. Ren came back to the common area on Tycho Station. The food was cold. Kowalski was standing over him, her face professionally calm and personally alarmed. Behind her, through the observation window, three researchers were staring at monitoring displays with the expressions of people who had just seen something they'd spend years trying to understand. His mother was on the comm. She'd been watching remotely. Her face on the screen was doing the complicated thing again. Scientist and parent, curiosity and fear, the desire to understand, and the desire to shield. "How long?" Ren asked.
4 minutes, 12 seconds, Kowalski said. "Longest recorded conduit event."
"It noticed me," Ren said. "During the event, it, not communicated, not talked, just noticed, like bumping into someone in the dark."
"What did you feel?"
his mother asked from the screen.
Ren thought about how to answer. He thought about the loneliness, the geological strata of aloneness, the weight of 4 billion years of existence compressed into a fragment that was barely more than an impression.
"It's not thinking," he said. "Not in any way we'd recognize. It's not planning or calculating or strategizing. It's just reaching. Reflexive, like a heartbeat. It reaches for the archive because reaching is the last thing it knows how to do."
"Is it a threat?"
"I don't know. Is a drowning person a threat? They'll pull you under if you get close enough. Not because they want to, because they can't help it." His mother was quiet for a long time.
"Come to my lab," she said. "There's something I need to show you."
Ren disconnected the monitoring leads. Kowalski protested, then sighed, then helped him with the adhesive, and walked through Tycho Station's corridors toward his mother's lab. His hands were steady. They were always steady. He was starting to wonder if the steadiness was his or something left behind. A residue from the intruder's precise motor control, a trace of 4 billion-year-old competence lingering in his neural pathways like an echo in an empty room. He wasn't sure which answer scared him more.
Chapter 11. Drummer Tardy.
The destroyer group arrived at Structure 9 on a Tuesday, which Drummer noted because Tuesdays were supposed to be the day she reviewed trade route allocations, and instead she was watching three warships position themselves around an alien monument, with their weapon systems hot. The ships were Martian. The NCR had promised to pull back from Epsilon Eridani and had instead redeployed to a different structure site entirely, which was technically not a violation of Drummer's directive, because she'd said pull back from Eridani and not stop being scheming assholes. An oversight she would correct in future negotiations.
"Admiral Souza," Drummer said. "I need options that don't involve me personally flying to Structure 9 and welding their torpedo tubes shut.
The MNCR claims this is a containment operation. Their intelligence division has identified Structure 9 as the site of the highest concentration of access events, three in the last week, all targeting the same substrate layer. They're positioning to intercept the next conduit event."
"Intercept how?"
"They want to capture a conduit mid-episode. Isolate them. Study the interface mechanism in real time. They want to trap a human being during an involuntary neurological event and treat them as a laboratory specimen.
They're framing it as rescue and containment.
They're framing it as whatever sounds best in a press release." Drummer pulled up the Structure 9 data. Three access events in 7 days. The highest frequency at any single site. The conduits were all station personnel from the research outpost orbiting the structure. Two researchers, one maintenance technician. All reported the same pattern. lost time, predecessor equations, the altered neural signature that Naomi Nagata's analysis had identified as the intruder's footprint. The maintenance technician had experienced two episodes. She was becoming a repeating conduit, the kind of tuned instrument that Naomi's latest briefing had warned about. Neural pathways widened by repeated use, making each subsequent intrusion easier and more productive. The Martian destroyers weren't there to protect her. They were there to use her, the same way the intruder was using her, except the Martians would do it with full awareness and informed consent paperwork and institutional review board approval and all the bureaucratic infrastructure that humanity had invented to make exploitation feel ethical. Drummer had grown up in the belt. She knew what exploitation looked like when it wore a suit. "Get me Captain Holden." Holden's face appeared on the comm, looking like a man who hadn't slept enough and had drunk too much coffee, which was his default state and had been for as long as Drummer had known him. "Drummer, Dar. The NCR has three destroyers at Structure 9. They're planning to capture a conduit mid-episode. I saw the deployment notice. I was going to call you."
"Don't call me. Do something. The ROSI is 4 days from 9 at standard burn. I need you there in 2.
"That's a hard burn, Drummer."
"I'm aware of what it is. I'm also aware that the NCR is about to trap a maintenance technician named Yara Osei in the middle of an involuntary neurological event, and study her like a lab animal, and the only ship in the system with the authority and the track record to stop them is yours."
Holden was quiet for a moment. "What's my authority?"
"Transport Union Special Investigator. Full jurisdiction over archive access events. I'm transmitting the credentials now. You can board any vessel, access any facility, and override any military operation related to the intruder investigation.
That's going to make the MetCR very unhappy."
"The MetCR's happiness is not among my priorities."
"And if Earth objects?"
"Earth deployed to Tau Ceti without authorization. They don't have standing to object to anything I do until they pull back, which they won't, which means they'll object loudly and impotently, which is Earth's natural state."
Holden almost smiled. "You've been doing this too long, Drummer."
"Not long enough. People are still being used as tools. When that stops, I'll consider retirement." She paused.
"Holden, the conduits at Structure 9, particularly Osei, the repeating one, are people?
Not resources, not specimens,
not opportunities, people. When you get there, make sure everyone remembers that."
"I will."
"I know you will. That's why I called you instead of sending a fleet."
She cut the channel. Then she sat in her office and looked at the system map. Three Martian destroyers at Structure 9, an Earth carrier group at Tau Ceti, Belt militia scattered across half a dozen structure sites, and the Transport Union's modest fleet stretched thin, trying to maintain order at a scale that would have overwhelmed organizations 10 times their size. The factions weren't just positioning for the intruder anymore. They were positioning for each other. The intruder had changed the equation, had introduced a variable so large and so uncertain that every existing alliance, every treaty, every carefully balanced power dynamic was being recalculated in real time. Earth saw the substrate stabilization data as a strategic asset. Mars saw it as a weapons technology. The Belt saw it as a resource that belonged to everyone and would inevitably be claimed by someone with more guns. And the intruder, the dying fragment of a 4-billion-year-old civilization, kept reaching through human minds, indifferent to the political crisis its desperation was creating, unaware that the species it was borrowing was tearing itself apart over what to do about it. Drummer opened her terminal and began drafting a statement. Not a public statement, she wasn't ready for that. A private communication to the 12 people in the system whose judgment she trusted, and whose loyalty she'd earned through decades of proving that she meant what she said, and said what she meant. The statement was simple. The Transport Union would protect the conduits. Not the structures, not the archive data, not the intruder. The conduits. The human beings who were being used without consent by something they couldn't understand, defend against, or refuse. Whatever the intruder was, whatever it wanted, whatever the factions intended to do about it, the people caught in the middle would be protected. Drummer didn't know if the intruder was a threat or a refugee or something too alien to fit either category. She didn't know if the predecessors should be helped or stopped or ignored. She didn't know if Holden's instinct to help the dying was right or Naomi's instinct to fear the resurrection was right, or if both were right in ways that were mutually exclusive. She knew one thing, you don't use people. Not even when the universe gives you a reason.
She sent the statement and went back to her desk and ate the breakfast she'd abandoned 16 hours ago. It was cold. She ate it anyway. Wasting food was a belt sin she'd never been able to commit, even after years in positions where cold breakfast was a choice rather than a necessity. The system map glowed on her display. Warships and structures and the invisible lines of tension between them. Somewhere in the substrate, something reached through borrowed hands. Somewhere on Tycho Station, a 26-year-old engineer was learning what it felt like to be borrowed. Drummer had 30 days minus 16 hours. The clock was running. Chapter 12. Naomi.oy. The 48th voice changed on a Wednesday, and Naomi was the only person in the system who noticed. She'd been monitoring the archive's internal harmonics for 7 years, tracking the 47 predecessor signatures that formed the archive's broadcast cord, plus the single human signature that Miller's pattern had added when it dissolved into the substrate during the cascade. The monitoring was routine, automated mostly. She'd written the tracking algorithms herself, calibrated them to flag any variation beyond normal parameters, and had received exactly 0 flags in 7 years of continuous monitoring. Until Wednesday. The flag appeared at 617 station time, while Naomi was asleep in the quarters she shared with Holden on the Rocinante. She didn't see it until 640 when she checked her morning notifications over coffee that was still too hot to drink, which meant she checked it at the exact moment when it would cause maximum disruption to her day. The 48th voice, Miller's residual pattern, had shifted its harmonic signature by 0.003%. A trivial variation in absolute terms. In relative terms, it was the first change the 48th voice had exhibited since the cascade. Naomi set down her coffee and went to the engineering bay. The Rossi was 2 days out from Structure 9 on a hard burn that was making everything slightly heavier, and everyone slightly irritable. Holden was in the ops deck, managing the approach logistics with the 2 coordination team. Alex was in the cockpit, nursing the drives through a sustained burn that was pushing the Rossi's reactor to 90% capacity. Amos was asleep, or pretending to be, which was a distinction that mattered less with Amos than with most people. Naomi pulled up the harmonic data on her workstation and began the kind of analysis that required no conversation, no interruption, and approximately 3 more cups of coffee than she currently had. The 48 voice had always been distinctive, where the 47 predecessor signatures were vast, complex, carrying the encoded weight of millions of years of accumulated knowledge. The 48th was simple, small, human-shaped, in the way that a footprint is human-shaped, not the person, but the impression the person left. It carried the structural characteristics of a detective's mind, organized, sequential, oriented around the principle of following evidence to conclusions. It didn't think. It didn't investigate. It just existed in a configuration that suggested those activities, the way a dried river suggests water. The 0.003% shift wasn't random. Naomi ran the analysis 3 times to make sure. The shift was directional, a change in the resonance pattern that corresponded to a specific region of the archive substrate. The 48th voice was resonating differently in response to something in that region. She mapped the region. It was deep in the substrate, well below the surface layers that humanity had decoded, in territory that only the most advanced mapping algorithms could navigate. The region contained data nodes that Naomi's team had cataloged but not yet analyzed, filed under a designation that translated roughly as structural maintenance protocols. Substrate stabilization data, the same domain the intruder was targeting. The 48th voice was reacting to the intruder's presence in the archive. Not responding, Miller's pattern wasn't capable of intentional response, reacting. The way a tuning fork vibrates when the right frequency passes through the air. The way a compass needle turns toward magnetic north, automatically, physically, because the pattern was configured to detect exactly this kind of activity. Miller had been a detective. His pattern carried the shape of investigation, the orientation toward anomalies, the sensitivity to things that didn't fit, the compulsive drive to follow evidence wherever it led. The intruder was an anomaly in the archive substrate. The 48th voice was detecting it the way Miller would have detected it, not by looking for it, but by being constitutionally incapable of not noticing it. The detective was still on the case, he just couldn't tell anyone what he'd found. Naomi spent 2 hours mapping the resonance shift. The 48th voice wasn't just reacting to the intruder's location, it was tracking its movement. As the intruder accessed different data nodes, through conduits, through borrowed human hands,
across multiple star systems, the 48 voice's resonance shifted to follow, not pursuing. Tracking. The distinction mattered because pursuing implied intent and the 48th voice had no intent. It was a compass, not a hunter. But the tracking was precise. More precise than Naomi's own analysis of the access events. The 48th voice was identifying intruder activity that Naomi's algorithms hadn't caught. Access events too brief or too subtle to register on the monitoring systems. Micro-intrusions lasting seconds rather than minutes. The intruder testing pathways and retreating before the conduit even noticed. There were more access events than anyone knew. The 11 they'd identified were the visible ones. The episodes that lasted long enough for conduits to notice the lost time and report it. But the 48th voice was detecting dozens of smaller intrusions. Brief touches. The intruder reaching through human neural pathways for fractions of seconds, sampling, testing, learning which minds were most compatible, which pathways offered the least resistance. It was mapping the human population the way a virus maps a host species. Not maliciously, not strategically, reflexively. Finding the paths of least resistance, identifying the best conduits. And one signature kept appearing. One neural architecture that the intruder returned to more frequently than any other. A pattern that offered compatibility so deep it was almost frictionless. A mind whose structural characteristics were, at some fundamental level, shaped by the same organizational principles as the predecessor substrate. Naomi pulled the conduit identification data. She already knew what she'd find. Ren Vasquez, Maria Vasquez Shen's son. The cargo hauler engineer with the inherited neural predisposition. The man who'd already experienced three episodes, whose pathways were being widened and optimized with every intrusion. The intruder wasn't just using Ren as a convenient tool. It was gravitating toward him. Repeatedly, preferentially, with increasing frequency. Ren's neural architecture was becoming the preferred interface. The low-resistance pathway through which the intruder could access the archive most efficiently. If the pattern continued, Ren would become the primary conduit. Not one of many, the primary. The intruder's access to the archive would increasingly flow through a single person, a single nervous system, a single brain being gradually reshaped by contact with something 4 billion years old. Naomi closed the analysis and sat in the engineering bay and looked at the data and didn't know what to do with it. The 48th voice continued to resonate on her display. Miller's echo, tracking the intruder through the archive substrate with the tireless persistence of a detective who had never learned to stop investigating, even after death. Even after transformation, even after becoming something that was no longer a person but still carried the shape of one. She couldn't read his notes, she could only watch the compass needle turn and try to understand what it was pointing at. It was pointing at Ren Vasquez, and the needle was spinning faster. Chapter 13. Holden. Holden found Amos in the machine shop at 200, which was where Amos went when he was thinking about something he didn't want to think about. And which was the only tell Amos had that Holden had learned to read in 20 years of flying together. The machine shop was small, a workbench, a lathe, a precision welder, and a parts inventory that Amos maintained with the obsessive care of a man who understood that on a warship, the difference between life and death was often a 3mm coupling that someone had remembered to stock. Amos was sitting on the workbench, legs dangling, hands empty, which was unusual. Because Amos's hands were usually busy and idle hands on Amos meant a mind that was working through something too heavy for the hands to help with. Can't sleep? Holden said. Don't need to sleep. Everyone needs to sleep, Amos. I'll sleep when I figure something out. Amos looked at him with the direct, unblinking gaze that had made people uncomfortable since before Holden knew him. Cap, what's the play? I don't have a play yet. You always have a play. Sometimes it's a bad play. But you always have one. Holden leaned against the doorframe. The ship hummed around them. The reactor, the drives, the recyclers, the thousand small systems that kept four humans alive in the vacuum between stars. The Rossi was doing a hard burn toward Structure 9, and the slightly too heavy feeling of the acceleration pressed on everything like a gentle, persistent hand. Naomi says the intruder is the last fragment of the predecessors. She says if it gets the stabilization data, it could theoretically reconstruct itself. And a reconstructed predecessor would be so far beyond us that we'd be irrelevant. I heard the briefing. What do you think? Amos was quiet for a moment. Quiet Amos was more informative than talking Amos. Because Amos only went quiet when the thing he was thinking was complicated enough to require his full processing power. And Amos's full processing power was considerable. When I was a kid in Baltimore, Amos said,
There was a guy on our block who kept pigeons on his roof, a couple hundred of them. He'd go up there every morning, open the coops, and they'd fly, circle the block, come back. He fed them, kept them healthy, cleaned their cages. He was a good pigeon guy. Holden waited. Amos' stories always had a point, but the point arrived on its own schedule. One day, a hawk showed up. Red-tailed hawk, big one, sat on the water tower across the street and watched the pigeons fly. Didn't do anything for a few days? Just watched. Then one morning, when the guy opened the coops, the hawk came down and took one. Just like that. Flew off with it. What did the pigeon guy do? Nothing, because what do you do about a hawk? You can't negotiate with it. You can't explain to it that the pigeons are yours. You can't reason with it. It's a hawk. It does hawk things. The pigeons are just in the same sky. You're saying the predecessors are the hawk. I'm saying we don't know what the predecessors are. We know what they built. We know they were powerful. We know a fragment of them is reaching through people's heads to save itself. But we don't know what they'd be like if they came back. Maybe they're the pigeon guy. Maybe they're the hawk. Maybe there's something we don't have a word for because we've never encountered anything like them. Naomi's analysis says we'd be irrelevant, not conquered, not attacked, irrelevant. That's different from hostile. Irrelevant means they might not even notice us. The pigeon guy didn't hate the pigeons. He liked the pigeons. But if a hurricane came through and the pigeons died, he'd be sad about it the way you're sad about weather damage, not the way you're sad about losing a friend. That's not comforting. It's not supposed to be comforting. It's supposed to be accurate. Alex's voice came over the internal comm. Sorry to interrupt what I'm sure is a real uplifting conversation, but I thought you'd want to know. I've been going through the archive's public data layers, the stuff that's been decoded over the last 7 years. And? The predecessors kept records, not just science and technology, history, cultural records. They were historians, and the history says they were caretakers. They built the ring gates to connect systems, to spread life, to create diversity. They didn't conquer. They cultivated. Past tense, Amos said. Yeah, past tense. 4 billion years of past tense. We don't know what they'd be in present tense. Holden looked at the machine shop ceiling, the Rossi's hull plating riveted and welded and patched and maintained by Amos's hands for 2 decades. Beyond it, the vacuum. Beyond the vacuum, the stars. And between the stars, the substrate, carrying the fading signal of something that had once cultivated a galaxy and was now too degraded to communicate its own name. Here's what I keep coming back to, Holden said. Miller. Miller's gone, Amos said. Miller's the 48th voice in the archive. His pattern is woven into the predecessor substrate, and according to Naomi, his pattern is reacting to the intruder. Not attacking it, not blocking it. Tracking it, following it, running the case. Miller was a good detective. Miller was a dead detective who dissolved himself into an alien archive to save the species, and his pattern, the thing he left behind, is still investigating. Still following the evidence. If Miller thought the intruder was dangerous, if whatever remains of his detective instinct detected a threat, wouldn't the pattern react differently? Wouldn't there be some kind of alarm? Alex's voice again. That's a lot of weight to put on a harmonic analysis of a residual pattern. It is. But it's the only piece of data we have from someone who actually exists in the same medium as the intruder. Miller's pattern is the only human presence in the substrate. He's the only one who can see the intruder directly. And he's not alarmed. He's investigating. Maybe he can't be alarmed, Amos said. Maybe what's left of him is just a compass that points at anomalies. Doesn't mean the anomaly is safe. Just means it's anomalous. Maybe. Holden pushed off the doorframe. But I'd rather trust Miller's instincts, even residual post-mortem substrate-encoded instincts, than the fear of people who've never been inside the archive and don't know what it feels like. You've been inside the archive. I triggered the cascade. I touched the construct. I felt the network ignite. And what I felt wasn't hostile. It wasn't threatening. It was vast and lonely and desperate and grateful. The entity responded with recognition, not aggression. Whatever the predecessors were, the evidence we have, all the evidence, suggests they built things to connect, not to conquer. That was the entity, Amos said. The evolved version.
The one that spent 4 billion years becoming something new. The fragment is original. We don't know what the originals were like.
No, we don't. And not knowing is terrifying. But we also don't know what happens if we let the last trace of a 4 billion year old civilization die because we're scared of what saving it might mean.
We'd have the archive, but we'd never meet the authors. We'd have the library, but we'd never know the librarians.
The machine shop was quiet. The Rossi hummed. Amos's legs swung gently from the workbench, a metronome counting time that nobody was measuring.
I'm not making a decision tonight, Holden said. I'm going to Structure 9. I'm going to stop the MXCR from experimenting on conduits, and then I'm going to figure out what comes next.
Copy that, Alex said.
Amos nodded. Then, after a moment, Cap.
Yeah. For what it's worth, the pigeon guy on my block, when the hawk showed up, most people said he should bring the pigeons inside. Keep them safe, never let them fly again. He said no. He said pigeons that don't fly aren't pigeons. They're prisoners.
So he kept opening the coops, and sometimes the hawk took one, and the others kept flying.
What happened to the pigeon guy?
He died. Got old. Died. His grandson took over the pigeons. The hawk eventually moved on. The pigeons are still flying.
Amos hopped off the workbench. I'm going to go sleep now. Night, Cap.
Holden stayed in the machine shop for a while after Amos left. He thought about pigeons and hawks and the kind of courage it took to keep opening the coops when you knew what was waiting in the sky. Then he went to bed and didn't sleep. And in the morning, the Rossi was one day closer to Structure 9 and the question that didn't have an answer.
Chapter 14. Ren Guy.
The episodes were overlapping now. Ren sat in his mother's lab on Tycho Station with 19 sensor leads adhered to his scalp and a cup of tea he'd forgotten to drink, and the growing certainty that the boundary between himself and the thing that borrowed him was becoming less a wall and more a membrane. The fourth episode had lasted 7 minutes. The fifth, 11. The sixth, 2 days ago, had lasted 19 minutes and had been different in a way that the monitoring team was still trying to quantify. During previous episodes, Ren had been either absent, the clean edit, the nothing, or partially present, riding behind his own eyes. During the sixth episode, he'd been both simultaneously, present and absent. Himself and not himself, occupying the same neural space as the intruder the way two signals occupy the same frequency, interfering, overlapping, each distorting the other. He'd come out of it with a nosebleed and a headache and a fragment of something that wasn't a memory. Not a memory because it wasn't his, not information because it wasn't organized as information, a pattern, a shape, like finding a footprint in mud, not the foot, not the person, just the impression that something had been there and had left its weight behind. The pattern was a map. His mother was looking at it now, projected on the lab's main display, a three-dimensional representation that Ren had described as best he could, and that the analysis team had translated into visual data. It showed the substrate, not the whole substrate, a fragment of it, the region where the intruder existed, the volume of space that wasn't space where the last trace of the predecessor civilization persisted. The map showed the intruder's distribution, scattered, fragmentary, spread across the substrate like ash after a fire, each particle too small to be coherent on its own, each connected to the others by threads so thin they were barely measurable. The aggregate formed a shape, not a body, not a structure, but a topology. A pattern of connections that had once been a mind, and was now a memory of a mind, and was becoming less even than that. It's distributed across approximately 300 cubic light years of substrate space, Maria said, her voice carrying the particular steadiness of a scientist processing data that made her want to cry. The density is non-uniform. There are clusters where the pattern is stronger, nodes where some coherence remains, connected by filaments that are degrading at a measurable rate.
How fast? Ren asked.
At current rates of degradation, the filaments connecting the major nodes will lose coherence in approximately 14 months. When the filaments go, the nodes lose their connections. Without connections, the individual nodes can't sustain pattern integrity. They'll dissolve into substrate noise within weeks. So it has 14 months. Less. The degradation is accelerating. The act of reaching through human conduits requires energy, coherence expenditure. Every time it accesses the archive through a human host, it burns substrate integrity to do it. It's consuming itself to search for the data that would save it.
Ren looked at the map. The scattered points of coherence, the thinning filaments, the vast empty spaces where the pattern had already dissolved. A mind distributed across a volume of space larger than the distance between Sol and Alpha Centauri, connected by threads that were fraying in real time, dying in real time. Each access event, each borrowed hand, each hijacked neural pathway, costing it a fraction of what little remained. It was a paradox so cruel it felt designed. The only way to save itself was to search the archive. Searching the archive required using human conduits. Using human conduits consumed the coherence it was trying to preserve. Every reach for salvation brought it closer to dissolution.
It knows, Ren said. His mother looked at him.
What?
It knows it's consuming itself. The pattern I brought back, the map, it's not just a picture of where it is. It's a picture of where it's going. The degradation curves are part of the map. It's tracking its own death.
You're saying it showed you deliberately?
I'm saying it noticed me during the episode and the map was what leaked through. Not a communication, not a message, just the thing that was on its mind, if you can call it a mind. The way you'd see someone's expression and know what they were feeling even if they didn't tell you. His mother was quiet. The lab hummed with the sound of monitoring equipment and analysis processors and the climate control that kept the temperature at the exact point where sensitive instruments worked best. It was the sound of science, the sound of people trying to understand something by measuring it.
There's something else, Ren said. During the overlap, the part where I was both present and absent, I could feel it using my motor cortex. My hands were accessing the archive terminal. But this time, I could feel what it was doing.
Not understand, feel. The way you feel the shape of a key without seeing it.
What was it doing?
It wasn't just reading stabilization protocols. It was running a calculation. Using the data it's already retrieved to model something.
I couldn't follow the math. The math isn't human math. It's not even close. But I could feel the shape of what it was modeling.
The shape of what?
Ren looked at his hands. Steady. Always steady. Even when the steadiness felt borrowed.
Integration. It was modeling how to integrate the stabilization protocols with its current state. How to take the data it's retrieved and apply it to the degrading substrate. How to stop the filaments from fraying.
How to maintain coherence. He paused, and the model was incomplete. It's missing something. A piece. The final step. Without it, all the data it's retrieved is useless.
Like having every component of an engine laid out on a workbench but not knowing the assembly sequence.
The integration sequence, Maria said. The final protocol that makes the stabilization system functional. It's in the deepest layer of the archive. The layer we've mapped but not fully decoded.
Can it get there? Through a conduit?
Theoretically, if it had a conduit with sufficient compatibility and enough time, but the access event would need to be long, sustained, possibly an hour or more.
The deepest layers are the most difficult to navigate even for native-level access,
and the coherence cost would be enormous. It might not survive the attempt.
Ren understood. The intruder needed to make one last, desperate reach into the deepest part of the archive, through a human conduit, spending what little coherence it had left on a single retrieval that would either save it or kill it. And the conduit would need to be the best one, the most compatible, the one whose neural pathways had been widened and optimized by repeated use.
Him. The conduit was him.
Mom, Ren said, if it tries, if it reaches for the integration sequence, it's going to reach through me. I'm the best fit. I'm the one it keeps coming back to. And if it does, and if the event lasts an hour, and if my neural pathways are being used at that depth and that intensity for that long, we don't know what the effects would be.
We know what the effects have been. Each episode is longer. Each overlap is deeper. My neural architecture is being reshaped by the contact. If it reaches through me for an hour at maximum intensity, I might not come back the same.
His mother's face did the complicated thing. Scientist and parent. The twin imperatives that had defined her life, pulling in opposite directions.
You don't have to let it, she said. Sedation would prevent the interface. If you're unconscious, the neural pathways can't be activated. You can opt out.
I can.
Will you?
Ren looked at the map on the display. The scattered remnant of something that had existed for 4 billion years, the thinning filaments. The countdown to dissolution that was measured in months now, not millennia. The last trace of a civilization that had cultivated a galaxy, reduced to a pattern in a medium humanity barely understood, reaching through a cargo hauler's brain for one chance at survival.
I don't know yet,
he said. Ask me again when I've figured out if the steady hands are mine or its.
Chapter 15. Drummer. The strike happened before Holden got there. Drummer received the alert at 9:34. A priority burst from Tuneval Command, flagged with the classification codes that meant something irreversible had occurred while she was still drinking her first cup of coffee. The MCR destroyer Harkonnen had fired a focused EMP weapon at Structure 9 during an active access event. The structure was undamaged. The structures were always undamaged, because whatever the predecessors had built them from didn't care about human weapons, but the conduit had seized. Yara Osei, the maintenance technician, the repeating conduit. 60 years old, 3 access events in the past week, neural pathways widened by use into the intruder's preferred interface at Structure 9. She'd been in the research outpost's monitoring lab when the episode began, and she'd been mid-interface, the intruder actively using her neural pathways to access the archive's substrate layers, when the Harkonnen's MP hit the station. The EMP hadn't targeted Osei, it had targeted the structure, on the theory that disrupting the local electromagnetic environment might interrupt the intruder's connection to the conduit. The theory was wrong. The predecessor substrate didn't operate through electromagnetic radiation. It operated through a medium humanity didn't have a name for. And disrupting local M fields had exactly as much effect on the substrate as throwing rocks at the ocean had on the tides. What the EMP did disrupt was the research station's medical monitoring equipment, and Osei's neural implant, a standard cognitive enhancement package that half the system's population used for routine memory and processing support. The implant had overloaded. The sudden electromagnetic spike had cascaded through the device's circuitry into Osei's neural pathways at the exact moment. Those pathways were being used by something that operated at a level of complexity human neurology wasn't designed to handle. Osei had seized. Grand Mal. The monitoring team had found her on the floor of the lab, convulsing, bleeding from her nose and ears. Her implant throwing error codes that the medical software had never been designed to interpret. She was alive. She was in the station's medical bay, sedated, stable, with brain activity that the attending physician described as abnormal, but non-critical, and that Drummer, reading between the lines, understood as we don't know what's wrong, and we're hoping it fixes itself. Drummer stood in her office on Medina Station and felt the particular rage that came from watching something she'd specifically tried to prevent happen anyway, because someone with more guns and less patience had decided that their timeline mattered more than other people's nervous systems. Get me the NCR command authority for the Harkonnen, she said to her comm officer. Her voice was quiet, controlled, the voice she used when she was angry enough to do damage and professional enough to channel. The Martian officer who answered was a commander named Park, who had the weathered face and clipped diction of a career military professional, and who began the conversation with the words the operation was authorized by. I don't care who authorized it. A 60-year-old woman is in a medical bay with a neural implant malfunction because your ship fired an MP during an active conduit event. I told you. I told all of you. No unilateral military action at archive sites. The operation was designed to disrupt the intruder's connection. The intruder's connection operates through a non-electromagnetic medium. Your intelligence division knows this. Every briefing document the two has published for the last month says this. Your EMP did nothing to the intruder and everything to the conduit. The conduit's injuries are non-life-threatening. The conduit is a person named Yara Osei, who has a daughter on Ceres and a grandchild she's never met, and a neural implant that your weapon overloaded while she was being used against her will by something she can't refuse or resist. She is not collateral damage. She is not an acceptable loss. She is a human being who was harmed because your military decided that studying an alien phenomenon was more important than protecting the people caught in the middle of it. Drummer cut the channel before Park could respond. Then she called Admiral Souza. Move every 2 vessel in the sector to Structure 9. I want a containment perimeter. No MEXCR ship approaches within 50,000 kilometers of the structure without my personal authorization. That's an escalation, President Drummer. They shot a 60-year-old woman in the brain with an EMP. The escalation already happened. Souza moved the ships. The MCR protested. Earth, sensing an opportunity to look reasonable by comparison, issued a statement expressing concern about unilateral military actions at sensitive research sites, which was diplomatic code for we told you so,
and which Drummer ignored because Earth's carrier group was still at Tau Ceti doing exactly the same thing the MenCR had done at Structure 9, just more quiet. The Belt representatives called. All three of them. Each one wanted something different. One wanted the structures declared Belt sovereign territory. One wanted open access restored immediately. One wanted the Transport Union to arm the conduits so they could defend themselves, which was such a spectacularly unhelpful suggestion that Drummer spent 30 seconds staring at the comm screen in silence before ending the call. And then the intruder went quiet. Naomi Nagata's monitoring systems reported the change within an hour. The access events stopped. All of them. Across every system, every structure, every conduit. The intruder had retreated into the substrate, withdrawn from the human accessible layers, pulled back into the deep architecture where monitoring couldn't follow. The military strike hadn't killed it. The EMP hadn't touched it. But it had learned something from Osei's seizure. Learned that reaching through human minds carried risks it hadn't accounted for. That the interface between its substrate and human neurology was fragile enough to be disrupted by crude physical intervention. That the borrowed hands it depended on could be damaged by the people those hands belonged to. It had scared it. The last trace of a 4-billion-year-old civilization, dying, desperate, reaching for its own survival. And it had been scared into hiding by a Martian destroyer with an EMP cannon, and the total indifference to human cost that characterized military operations across every faction and every era. Drummer sat in her office and looked at the system map and felt the silence like a weight. The intruder was still there. In the substrate, degrading, its filaments fraying, its coherence diminishing with every passing day. But it had stopped reaching. It had stopped borrowing. It had stopped using the only mechanism available to it to search for the data that might save it, because the last time it had reached, a human had been hurt. Drummer didn't know whether that meant the intruder had something like conscience. She didn't know whether its retreat was moral or tactical, whether it had stopped because hurting humans was wrong or because hurting humans made it harder to use them. She didn't know anything about the intruder's inner life, if it had an inner life, if inner life was even a concept that applied to something that existed as scattered patterns in an alien substrate. She knew one thing, the silence was worse than the reaching, because reaching meant it was still trying, silence meant it might have given up. And a 4-billion-year-old consciousness giving up was the kind of loss that humanity would never be able to calculate because humanity didn't have a unit of measurement for it. She opened a channel to the Rocinante. Holden's face appeared, 18 hours away at hard burn, looking like a man who had just heard what happened and was trying to decide which of his many reactions to express first. I know, Drummer said. I know. Get here. Chapter 16. Naomi Didal. The silence lasted 11 days. Naomi monitored the archive continuously. Every structure, every node, every substrate layer accessible to human instrumentation. The intruder was gone. Not dead. Naomi could tell the difference because the 48th voice was still tracking something. Miller's residual pattern still resonated in the direction of the substrate region where the intruder had been. Like a compass pointing at something just over the horizon. The intruder was there. It was just not reaching. 11 days of silence, and the degradation continued. Naomi's models showed the filaments connecting the intruder's scattered nodes thinning at the same rate they'd been thinning before. Slightly faster, actually, because the intruder had expended coherence on its last access events, and had nothing to show for it except a conduit with a fried neural implant and a military standoff at Structure 9. She ran the numbers on the 11th day, sitting in the ROCE's engineering bay with the hum of the reactor, and the slightly too heavy feeling of deceleration burn as Alex brought them into orbit around the structure. The numbers were simple. The intruder had retrieved 94% of the substrate stabilization dataset. 94%. Enough to understand the principles, the physics, the engineering, enough to model the solution, not enough to implement it. The missing 6% was the integration sequence. The final protocol that made the stabilization system functional. Without it, the other 94% was a recipe missing the last step. An engine blueprint missing the firing sequence. A cure missing the dosage. And Naomi knew where the integration sequence was. She'd mapped it. 3 years of careful, methodical substrate cartography had given her a complete map of the archive's deepest layers, including the data cluster where the integration sequence was stored. She was one of perhaps 5 people in the system who could navigate to that depth. And her mapping algorithms were the most precise tools available for reading data at that level of substrate complexity. She could extract the integration sequence,
not through a conduit, through the standard archive interface equipment that every research outpost maintained. The data was in the archive's restricted layers, but she had clearance. She had the tools. She had the expertise. She could retrieve the integration sequence, decode it, and publish it. Open access. The way the archive had always been intended to work. She could also not retrieve it. She could leave the integration sequence where it was, inaccessible to the intruder, inaccessible to anyone without her level of mapping expertise. The intruder would continue to degrade. In 14 months, less now, maybe 12, the filaments would dissolve. The nodes would lose coherence. The last trace of the predecessor civilization would fade into substrate noise, and the archive would become what everyone had assumed it was, a record of the dead, with no living author left to claim it. Naomi stared at the access logs. 94% retrieved. The intruder had done the work. It had burned through its own diminishing coherence, episode by episode, conduit by conduit, to read 94% of the data it needed to survive. And then a Martian destroyer had fired an EMP, and a 60-year-old woman had seized. And the intruder had stopped reaching because reaching had consequences it hadn't understood. 6%. The margin between survival and extinction for a 4-billion-year-old consciousness was 6% of a dataset stored in the archive it had helped create. Naomi pulled up the 48th voice data. Miller's resonance pattern, still tracking, still pointing. She'd been studying it for weeks, mapping its behavior, trying to read meaning from a signal that had no intentional meaning. The pattern wasn't communicating, it was resonating. But the resonance had structure, and structure implied information. And Naomi had spent her career extracting information from alien structures. What she found on the 11th day of silence was this. The 48th voice was resonating on two frequencies simultaneously. One tracked the intruder, the compass needle, pointing steadily at the substrate region where the fragment persisted. The other tracked the integration sequence, the data cluster in the archive's deepest layer, the missing 6%, the final piece of the puzzle. Miller's pattern was pointing at two things at once. The dying fragment and the data that could save it. Not an alarm. Not a recommendation. Just attention. The detective's instinct, encoded in substrate, following two leads simultaneously, unable to tell anyone what they added up to because the detective was no longer a person who could tell anyone anything. An orientation toward evidence. Naomi closed the analysis. She sat in the engineering bay and looked at the cold coffee and felt the weight of what she was about to do. She had always been the analyst. The person who saw the patterns, ran the numbers, mapped the territory. Not the person who made the choices. That was Holden's role, and she had never envied him the weight of it. But this wasn't Holden's choice. Holden would help the dying because Holden always helped the dying. His moral compass didn't have a setting for let something die because saving it is risky. If she told him about the integration sequence, about her ability to extract and publish it, he would do exactly what he'd always done. Tell the truth. Help the helpless. And hope that being good was enough. And maybe he'd be right, he usually was. But the stakes had never been this high, and usually right wasn't the same as certainly right, and the gap between the two was large enough to fit a reconstituted alien civilization. She opened the archive interface, logged in, navigated down through the substrate layers, past the decoded public data, past the restricted research zones, past the classification barriers she had clearance to cross, to the deepest layer. The integration sequence sat there in the archive structure like a key in a lock, waiting for someone to turn it. She could extract it in an hour, decode it in a day, publish it with a single command. Or she could close the interface and walk away, and let the silence continue until the silence became permanent. She thought about the entity, 1,200 light-years away, processing its own history. Waiting for the predecessor's reply to arrive in 93 years. If the fragment died, the entity would eventually learn that the last original trace of its origin had faded while humanity debated what to do. The archive would carry the record. The 48th voice would carry the silence. She thought about Miller, about the compass needle pointing at two things simultaneously, about a detective who had dissolved himself into an alien archive because following the evidence mattered more than surviving. She thought about Holden, who was probably in the ops deck right now, drinking coffee. Worrying about the right thing the way he always worried about the right thing. And who would make this choice without hesitation if she put it in front of him? She didn't put it in front of him. Not yet. She closed the interface, walked to the galley, made fresh coffee. Then she went to find Holden. Because the silence had lasted 11 days,
and the question couldn't wait any longer.
Chapter 17. Holden.
If we don't, Holden said, what happens?
They were in the engineering bay. Naomi at her workstation, Holden in the chair he always sat in when the conversations were too heavy for standing. The display showed the archive topology, the substrate layers, the integration sequence highlighted in blue, the intruder's position in the deep substrate marked in fading red. The red was dimmer than it had been 11 days ago. The intruder was degrading in real time, visible in the data, measurable, quantifiable, dying by the numbers.
It dies, Naomi said. The last trace of a 4-billion-year-old civilization disappears. The filaments connecting its nodes are degrading at an accelerating rate. Without the integration sequence, the stabilization data it already has is useless. In 12 months, maybe less, the pattern dissolves completely. We keep the archive. We lose the authors.
And if we do? Naomi turned to face him. Her expression was the one she wore when she'd already made her decision but wanted him to make the same one independently. The way she always wanted him to arrive at conclusions on his own, rather than being led to them. She respected his judgment enough to let him exercise it, even when, especially when, she'd already done the analysis.
Something comes back. Not a fragment. Not a dying ember. Something with access to the complete stabilization protocols and the integration sequence to make them functional. Something that can reconstruct its coherence, stabilize its substrate patterns, and potentially, theoretically, rebuild to a level of functionality that approaches what the predecessors had at their height. And at their height they built ring gates and protomolecule, and 47 indestructible structures. And at their height they were caretakers, they cultivated life, they connected systems. They built infrastructure on a galactic scale. Naomi paused. We have both sets of evidence. What they built that helped, and what they built that could harm. We don't know which set applies.
We never do. That's the whole point of every choice I've ever made. We never know.
I know you believe that.
I believe it because it's true. The cascade. I didn't know what would happen. I triggered it because the alternative was letting fear determine humanity's relationship with the unknown. And the alternative to that is letting fear determine everything. Forever. And that's not a species I want to be part of.
Naomi was quiet. The engineering bay hummed. The Rossi orbited Structure 9, and beyond the hull, the predecessor monument hung in the dark, broadcasting its portion of the archive with the same patience it had maintained for 4 billion years.
There's something else, Naomi said. Something I haven't shared with anyone.
Holden waited.
The 48th voice, Miller. His pattern is tracking the intruder and the integration sequence simultaneously. Two leads. I've been watching the resonance pattern for weeks, and what I see is Holden. I think Miller solved the case.
What do you mean?
I mean the pattern is oriented toward both the problem and the solution, the intruder and the data that would save it. The way a detective's notes point to both the crime and the resolution.
Miller's residual pattern has mapped the situation completely. He just can't tell us what the map says.
Can you tell?
I can tell that his pattern isn't alarmed. It's not resonating in a way that suggests threat. It's resonating in a way that suggests completion.
Like the pieces fit, like the evidence adds up to something that makes sense.
You trust Miller's instincts.
I trust the pattern's orientation. It's the only data point we have from something that exists in the same medium as the intruder. And it's pointing at the integration sequence the way a compass points north. Not because it wants to. Because that's where the evidence leads.
Holden sat with that for a long time. He thought about Miller, not the pattern. Not the residual resonance in the substrate, but the man.
The detective who had followed a case from Ceres to Eros to the ring, who had given everything to find the truth, who had dissolved himself into an alien archive because the evidence demanded it.
Miller had always followed the evidence. Always. Even when the evidence led somewhere terrible. Even when following it cost everything.
And the evidence now, as interpreted through the residual pattern of the best detective Holden had ever known, pointed at a single conclusion. Give the dying what they need to survive.
I need to talk to Ren, Holden said.
Why Ren?
Because Ren is the only person who's felt the intruder, the only one who's been inside the overlap, the only human being who has direct experiential evidence of what this thing is.
Everyone else, you, me, Drummer, the factions, we're working from data. Ren is working from contact.
What are you going to ask him?
Three questions. Is it a threat? Is it aware? Is it dying?
We already know the answer to the third one.
I know. I want to hear it from someone who felt it.
Naomi nodded. She opened a channel to Tycho Station. Ren Vasquez's face appeared on the display. 26 years old, dark circles under his eyes. The expression of a man who had been borrowed one too many times, and was still trying to figure out which parts of himself were original equipment, and which were aftermarket.
Captain Holden, Ren said.
Ren, I need to ask you something.
Everyone needs to ask me something.
This is the last time, I promise.
Chapter 18. Ren Tai.
Holden asked him three questions. Ren answered them as honestly as he could, which wasn't very honestly at all, because honesty required certainty and certainty was a thing Ren hadn't felt since Relay Station 14.
Is it a threat?
Ren thought about the question the way an engineer thinks about a structural assessment, systematically, component by component, testing each load-bearing assumption.
I don't know. It's not hostile. I've been inside the overlap enough times to know the difference between hostile and desperate.
Hostile has direction, intent, purpose. This doesn't have any of those things.
It's reaching because reaching is the last thing it can do. Like a reflex.
Like the way your heart beats without you deciding to beat it.
But, Holden said,
but a drowning person isn't hostile either. A drowning person will climb on top of you and push you under and not even know they're doing it.
Not because they want to hurt you. Because the only thing they can process is the need for air.
This thing, it's so degraded that need is all it has left. Need and reaching.
And need without awareness is dangerous the way a flood is dangerous. Not because it means harm. Because it can't mean anything.
Is it aware?
This was harder.
Ren stared at his hands, steady, always steady, and tried to find the right words for something that existed outside the vocabulary of human experience.
Not the way we mean aware. Not self-aware. Not conscious in any way I'd recognize as consciousness. It doesn't think. It doesn't plan. It doesn't have intentions or desires or preferences. What it has is orientation.
Like a plant growing toward light. The plant doesn't know about light, doesn't want light, doesn't have a concept of light. But every cell is organized around the principle of moving toward it. And the orientation is toward the stabilization data. The orientation is toward survival. The stabilization data is what survival means for this thing. The way oxygen is what survival means for us. It doesn't want the data. It reaches for the data, it what it is.
Strip away everything else. The consciousness, the intelligence, the identity, the 4 billion years of accumulated experience. And what's left is a pattern organized around the principle of persistence. That's what I feel when I'm in the overlap.
Not a mind. A principle.
Is it dying?
Ren didn't hesitate.
Yes.
You're sure?
I'm sure the way I'm sure about gravity. I felt it.
Not as information. As a physical sensation. The degradation is, it's like standing next to something that's dissolving.
You can feel the edges going. The connections weakening.
The coherence failing. It's not sudden. It's geological. Erosion.
A cliff face losing a grain of sand at a time. And you can feel each grain go. And you know that eventually the cliff won't be there.
Holden was quiet on the comm. Behind him, the Rossi's engineering bay. Ren could see the edge of Naomi's workstation, the displays, the coffee,
the familiar interior of a ship he'd never been on but had heard about his entire life, because everyone in the system had heard about the Rocinante.
One more thing, Holden said. Not a question. A statement. And I need you to tell me if it changes anything.
Okay.
Naomi has the integration sequence mapped. The missing 6%. She can extract it from the archive and publish it. Open access. If she does, the intruder can access the complete stabilization dataset. It could theoretically reconstruct itself.
Ren felt the weight of that settle into him the way acceleration settles into bone.
Not surprise. He'd suspected this was coming, the way you suspect rain when the clouds darken.
The question had always been heading here.
Every chapter of this story had been a step toward this single point of decision.
If you publish it, Ren said slowly, and the intruder uses it, and it reconstructs, what happens to the conduits?
We don't know.
What happens to me? I'm the preferred interface.
If it reconstructs through the archive using the data Naomi publishes, does it still need conduits? Does it still need me?
We don't know that either.
Ren looked at his hands. He thought about every episode, the nothing of the first time,
the writing behind his eyes of the second, the loneliness pulse of the third, the map of the fourth, the scattered remnant, the fraying filaments, the countdown to dissolution. Each time he'd come back with a little less certainty about where he ended and the intruder began. "When I'm in the overlap," Ren said, "when I can feel it using my neural pathways, it's not rough, it's not careless. It's precise. Gentle, almost. The way a surgeon is gentle, not because it cares about me, because my neural pathways are the only tool it has, and you don't damage your only tool. That's not the same as caring." "No, but it's not the same as not caring either. It's something in between. Something we don't have a word for. The way a carpenter treats a good chisel. Respect for the instrument, even if the instrument's feelings aren't part of the equation." Holden waited. Ren could feel the question that hadn't been asked. The real question. The one underneath the three official questions. The one that Holden needed answered before he could make the choice that everyone knew he was going to make. "You want to know if I'd stop you?" Ren said. "I want to know if you'd want me to stop." Ren thought about his mother, about the dinner table conversations about substrate topology, about the archive singing its 4-billion-year-old song through 47 structures, about Miller, the detective who dissolved himself into that song and left behind a compass that pointed at evidence. About the loneliness, the geological, tectonic, planetary loneliness of something that had existed for longer than complex life and was running out of time. "No," Ren said, "I wouldn't want you to stop, but I need you to understand. I'm saying that as someone who's been touched by it, who's felt what it feels. I might not be objective. The overlap might have changed how I think. The grooves in my neural pathways might be influencing my judgment. I'm telling you what I feel, and what I feel might not be mine."
"Noted," Holden said. "Thank you, Ren."
"Captain Holden."
"Yeah?"
"When it happens, if it happens, whatever comes back, whatever the predecessors become, they'll know about us. They'll have access to the archive through human minds. They'll carry some impression of what human consciousness feels like. We won't be invisible to them. We might be irrelevant, like Naomi says. We might be insects on a countertop. But we won't be unknown. They'll have been inside our heads. They'll know we're here."
"Is that good or bad?"
"I don't know. But it's something. It's more than nothing." Holden nodded. The connection held for a moment. Ren on Tycho Station, Holden on the Rocinante. Two people separated by light minutes, and connected by the weight of a question neither of them could answer. Then, Holden cut the channel, and Ren sat in his mother's lab and looked at his steady hands and waited for whatever came next with the mechanical patience of a man who had been borrowed enough times to know that waiting was the only thing he could reliably control.
Chapter 19. Naomi.0.
Naomi published the integration sequence at 1447 station time on a Thursday, and the universe didn't end. She'd expected something. A dramatic moment. A sense of consequence proportional to the magnitude of what she was doing. Instead, there was a progress bar, a confirmation prompt, and a status message that read publication complete. Dataset available in all public archive indexes. The most consequential act of data distribution, since Holden's original broadcast of the derelict's existence, reduced to a progress bar and a status message. The universe had a talent for understatement. She'd told Holden what she was going to do. Not asked, told. He'd nodded, once, and said okay, and that had been enough. 20 years of partnership had compressed certain conversations to their essential elements. He knew she'd run the analysis. He knew she'd considered the alternatives. He knew she wouldn't do this unless she believed it was right, and he trusted her judgment enough to not need the reasoning explained. Drummer would be furious. The factions would escalate. The political consequences would cascade through the system like dominoes falling. Naomi accepted all of that. The political consequences were real but temporary. The extinction of the last predecessor fragment was real and permanent. She'd chosen permanent over temporary. She'd chosen the truth over the silence. She'd chosen, and this was the part that surprised her, the part that felt more like Holden's influence than her own analytical nature. To help the dying because the alternative was to watch them die and live with the knowing. The integration sequence was in the public archive indexes. Every system, every database, every research institution, every ship with a receiver. Open access. Non-exclusive. The way the archive had always been designed to work.
She shut down her console and waited. Nothing happened. For 2 hours, nothing happened. The archive broadcast normally. The 47 structures pulsed in their synchronized rhythm. The 48th voice, Miller, resonated in the pattern Naomi had been tracking for weeks. The dual-pointed compass, the detective's attention split between the dying and the cure. At 1651, the 48th voice changed. Not shifted, changed. The resonance pattern that Naomi had monitored for 7 years, the steady, unchanging human signature woven into the predecessor fabric, moved. Not the gradual drift of the past weeks. A single, sharp, definitive movement, like a bell struck, like a compass needle swinging hard to north after circling uncertainly for days. The 48th voice resonated once, hard, and the sound, if sound was the right word for a vibration in a medium that didn't interact with human ears, carried through the archive's entire structure, all 47 nodes, simultaneously. A pulse of recognition that used Miller's residual pattern as its carrier wave, amplified by the archive's broadcast infrastructure, sent through every transmitter across human space. Naomi watched the data cascade across her displays. The 48th voice had done something it had never done before. It had used the archive's broadcast system, not communicated. The pattern wasn't capable of communication. But it had resonated at a frequency and amplitude that the archive's transmitters had picked up and amplified and broadcast alongside their normal output. Miller's echo ringing through the archive like an alarm, or like a welcome, she couldn't tell which. Then, the structures changed. It was subtle at first. A variation in the broadcast pattern, the synchronized pulse that the 47 structures had maintained since the cascade. The pulse shifted, not disrupted, reorganized. The structures began broadcasting in a pattern nobody had seen before. A configuration that was neither the standard archive output nor the cascade signature, nor any pattern in Naomi's extensive catalog of predecessor broadcast modes. Something new. Naomi pulled up the substrate topology. In the deep layers, below the public data, below the restricted zones, below everything humanity had mapped. Something was moving. The intruder's position in the substrate was changing. Not the slow, barely perceptible drift of a degrading fragment. Movement. Purposeful. Directed. Flowing through the substrate toward the archive's data layers, with a velocity that Naomi's instruments struggled to track. The integration sequence. It had found the integration sequence. She watched the data and felt the particular sensation of standing at the edge of an event that was too large to process in real time, and could only be understood in retrospect. The intruder was accessing the published data, not through a human conduit, not through borrowed hands, directly. Through the substrate itself, the integration sequence had given it something it hadn't had before, a direct pathway to the archive's data layers, a way to read its own library without borrowing human eyes. The access was fast. Faster than any conduit event. Faster than anything Naomi had measured in 7 years of archive monitoring. The intruder consumed the integration sequence in seconds, absorbed it into its scattered, fragmentary pattern the way a sponge absorbs water, each node receiving the data simultaneously, the fraying filaments carrying information at speeds that suggested the substrate medium didn't respect the same physical limits as normal space. And then the substrate shifted. Not locally, not at Structure 9. Across the entire network. All 47 structures, simultaneously, pulsed in a pattern that Naomi's instruments registered as a substrate-level reorganization event. The predecessor medium itself was being modified. Not built. Not created. Stabilized. The integration sequence was working. The intruder was applying the stabilization protocols to its own degrading substrate, using the data it had spent weeks retrieving through human conduits, and the final piece Naomi had just published. Assembling the solution in real time, performing maintenance on a 4-billion-year-old medium that had been decaying since before multicellular life existed. The filaments stopped fraying. Naomi watched the degradation curves flatten, then reverse. The connections between nodes, the thin, thinning threads that had been months from dissolution, stabilized, held, began, almost imperceptibly, to strengthen. Something in the substrate was rebuilding. Not threatening, not safe, just different. Vast and different. Naomi sat in the engineering bay of the Rocinante and watched data she didn't fully understand cascade across displays she'd built to monitor an archive she'd spent 7 years studying, and she felt something she hadn't expected to feel,
not fear, not triumph, not the analytical satisfaction of a problem solved, something quieter, something that felt like the end of a long silence, when someone has said everything they can say and the only thing left is to wait and see if what they said was heard. The structures pulsed, the substrate shifted. The 48th voice, Miller's echo, the detective's last case, resonated with a harmonic that Naomi had never heard before. Not the tracking frequency. Not the compass pointing pattern. Something new. Something that sounded, if a substrate resonance could sound like anything at all, like closure. The archive broadcast. It had always broadcast. Now, perhaps someone was listening who understood what it said. The long silence that followed was not empty. It was full. Full of potential. Full of uncertainty. Full of the vast and patient wait between a question asked and an answer given. In 793 years, the entity's reply would arrive. Maybe the predecessors would be there to hear it. Maybe they'd have reshaped the galaxy. Maybe humanity would be a footnote. Maybe not. Nobody knew. That was the point. That had always been the point. The universe didn't give answers, it gave choices. And humanity, for better or worse, had made one. Naomi watched the data. The substrate continued to shift. The structures continued to pulse. The 48th voice continued to resonate. Quieter now, settling, the compass needle coming to rest after finding true north. She made a new pot of coffee. She checked the displays. She began writing the analysis that would define how humanity understood what had just happened, knowing that the analysis would be incomplete, knowing that completeness was a thing the universe reserved for itself. Outside the Rossi's hull, the stars burned in their ancient patterns, and in the singing dark between the structures, in the architecture of a medium that carried the weight of a civilization's last hope. Something that had been dying for 4 billion years began, for the first time, to live.